Comedy Rapport with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Rapport with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, July 21st, 2026. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, will be with us to discuss the latest on Trump's war in Iran. War on Iran, rather. Also on the program, the Pentagon has been covering up troop injuries in the Iran war, as U.S. intelligence tells the White House that more bombing isn't going to soften the Iranian position.
We've had a lot more.
You consider that? Israel's far-right finance minister, Smotrich, brags about how the U.S.'s war on Iran is ideal for them, because Israel doesn't have to get involved. Thanks for saying that out loud, buddy. Israel has killed at least 10 Palestinians in the past 24 hours as half the Israeli government joins marches at the Gaza border calling for settlements. This is not a Netanyahu problem. This was to pressure Netanyahu to do this. Some good news, though. A federal judge has put Paramount Skydance's takeover of Warner Brothers on hold after a lawsuit from 12 state attorneys general. A coalition of billionaires led by Google co-founder Sergey Brin are launching an $87 million ad campaign against California's wealth tax ballot initiative. Trump says he will impose a 50% tariff on Canadian goods because they hate our cars. The DOJ is opening an investigation into Harvard giving financial aid to and accuses DSA of collaborating with them.
And Amy Goodman.
You see where this is going, right? Yeah. The Trump administration is killing a swath of federal energy efficiency programs as your electric bills explode. The top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, Jamie Raskin, is launching an investigation into Jeffrey Epstein's intelligence work for foreign governments. Interesting. And lastly, the Trump administration sought phone records of New York Times reporters and their families after they investigated the plane that Qatar gifted to him. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is Newsday Tuesday. We recorded this conversation with Trita Parsi earlier this morning. It was super informative about the latest on the Iran war, the endless war that Trump has dragged us into. But let's start here. As I should say, though, Sam is fine. He will be back. It seems like it's going to be, we can give a timeline, right? This week and next week. He's going to be out?
Yeah, somewhere around the 31st.
Somewhere around there, yeah. So you're stuck with me. You're stuck with me. It'll be a great episode when he does come back, though. And I will be taking a vacation after that for a little while. What?
I mean, how do you know it's going to be a great episode?
I guess that's true. He could be so rusty.
Well, it's good to say that, though.
I mean, yes.
might be horrible news that day.
It could be. It could be. Although the pattern tends to be that horrible news comes when he's out.
You know, it's going to be a great show. We've got a lot to cover, all that stuff. That's just shit you say.
Yes. good job promoting the show, producer Brian. Less of a good job on doing that, Matt.
I'm just trying to be real.
I understand. People appreciate our honesty, I guess. Right now in the House, Mike Johnson and Russ Vought are trying to get Republicans on board with Trump's bag of goodies in the reconciliation package, which includes a $95 billion chunk in supplemental funding for the war in Iran and also farm aid caused by that is necessary because Trump raised fertilizer prices and energy prices so much from this war in Iran. So ripping us off, ripping the taxpayer off.
Further in consolidation of farms.
Yep. That the reason that they need this aid is because, as I mentioned, of Trump's own choices.
But suffice to say, there won't be more small farmers in business right now as there will be. There will be fewer in the coming days.
Absolutely.
In months, yeah.
And they like this kind of consolidation, as you say. Their donors would love to buy up farms on the cheap and continue to have, monopolies across the country. But we're not sure ahead of the August recess if Republicans are going to be able to pull this off, because Trump wants to shoehorn the Save America Act into the reconciliation bill, which, I don't understand how necessarily they're going to do that, because it's not pertaining to the budget, but he wants to either nuke the filibuster or create some sort of budgetary reason for the Save America Act, I believe, to be in these negotiations and in this bill. But regardless, they're attempting to pass the Save America Act ahead of the recess. And John Thune and the Senate are not too happy about this. But Trump wants this because it's a mass voter disenfranchisement bill based on essentially a Nazi lie about great replacement theory, because they are trying to claim that immigration is an attempt by the Democrats to replace white people and to vote in elections and take away your voice. We know that non-citizen voting in the U.S. is so insanely rare. There have been many analyses of this, and voter fraud in particular. The Heritage Foundation, which is a right-wing think tank, the right-wing think tank, essentially, one arguably the most important conservative organization in the country, they looked at voter fraud instances or instances of non-citizen voting from 2003 to 2022. So almost essentially a 20-year period. You know how many times they found voter fraud or non-citizen voting? 23 instances.
I'd also just mention the Heritage Foundation is named in Mahmoud Khalil's suit against the government on the Klan Act for conspiring with Zionist groups like Canary Mission and Batar to slander people for expressing their free speech and indeed persecute them for their free speech on Palestine.
Yeah, good note. So we're not Heritage Foundation fans here, but if any group has an incentive to overplay these instances of voter fraud, it would be
right.
The Heritage Foundation. Now, here is Steve Scalise being asked about these efforts to mandate certain kinds of ID for voting, which would impact 9% of American citizens of voting age who don't have this kind of proof of citizenship that is required. And of course, it's going to impact people of color and marginalized communities and poor people and rural people as well, because of the attack and disabled people because of the attacks on mail-in voting. But that's 9% of Americans would be disenfranchised by this, by the Bipartisan Policy Center's estimates. That's 21 million people. And that is, I think, a conservative estimate here, because that's just like direct. There are, something like 70 million women in this country who don't have on their birth certificate the name that they've changed, their married name. They're married, and that would not suffice in terms of proving their citizenship, because you need two different forms of ID based on this. You need a real ID, an updated real ID. a valid U.S. passport or a military ID also applies. And then you would also need secondary documents like birth certificates to prove your citizenship. It's ridiculous. But Steve Scalise doesn't seem to think so, because he says that you use your voter ID all the time, including at places like the Olive Garden.
Show and picture ID to vote. Not a complicated subject. Again, anybody that gets on an airplane has to show a picture ID to vote. Nowadays, if you want to go to Olive Garden and get unlimited pasta, you got to show a picture ID. This isn't complicated stuff. Yet every Democrat is against these basic things. Why? The only reason you can be against that is if you want voter fraud.
Okay, then why hasn't it happened yet, buddy? Why has there been basically no voter fraud? It's amazing. They keep doing this. Trump says you need your ID to enter a grocery store. You're telling on yourselves, you guys, that you're rich as hell and are so out of touch.
We have to answer his question. Why would anyone want to do this without, if not to allow illegal immigration or illegal immigrants to vote? It's because, why are they doing it? It's because they want to disenfranchise people that don't have IDs.
Exactly. And I just love this claim about, yeah, okay, perhaps to subscribe to unlimited pasta at Olive Garden, you might need to show your ID, I guess, in theory, to be a part of this subscription service and prove that, hey, I'm the guy that shelled out for the Olive Garden pasta subscription, which I gotta say, I have a little bit of judgment towards you, if that's the case.
Yeah. I think you should be put on a government list if you sign up for unlimited pasta from Olive Garden.
Exactly. What's also insane about what he's saying is that if you're going to use the Olive Garden example, bro, or the airplane example, it doesn't work because you need a secondary form of identification and citizenship. Awesome. So the ID doesn't work.
Olive Garden is also a private business that doesn't need to serve you unlimited pasta. Whereas, like, there should be, your vote should be taken.
Right. It's just one of the dumber, examples that they've given in trying to sell this. You know, incredibly
showing my ID to TGI Fridays.
Yeah, I'm like this rollback of people's, you know, franchise really, and their ability to participate in elections. They can't come up with a better example for what they're trying to do here, because it's all based on a conspiracy theory, and it's all at the whims of this capricious and psychotic president who sees the only path he sees to maintaining power is through cheating.
Who tried to steal the 2020 election.
Yeah. Remember that? That was kind of a big deal. And this comes up here.
But now he's concerned about, election security,
integrity.
For sure.
That's what Mike Johnson and Trump really care about. He's asked Mike Johnson here about how, is it helpful that Trump keeps relitigating the 2020 election? And this is relevant for the Save America Act. Here he is answering this question this morning at the House Republican presser.
This is probably the last time we're going to see a press conference before the House leaves for recess. Members going home to campaign ahead of the midterm elections. The control of the House is up for grabs. Last week, President Trump gave a speech relitigating the 2020 election and bringing up claims of election fraud. Do you think it would serve your most vulnerable members, the majority makers, well, if President Trump stopped relitigating the 2020 election and moved on from that one?
Well, I didn't hear him in that address say he wasn't relitigating the 2020 election. What he did was, I got a couple notes here, but some of the things that he announced 280,000 non-citizens have been found to be on voter rolls in America. I mean, if that doesn't cry for the passage of the Save America Act into law, I don't know what does.
Okay,
he announced that foreign adversaries have compromised American election data.
I just want to fact check that really quickly. The 278,000 non-citizens being unlawfully registered is a highly, highly disputed figure. Most election experts say it's wildly overstated. And once again, registration, even if you were to take that claim at face value, doesn't mean that they voted in the election. Why would you, in this context, in this country, when Trump is locking up people and throwing them into gulags, and over 50 people have died in ICE custody so far during his second term, Why the hell would you risk it to vote in your local municipal election by showing up at a polling place?
Yeah, if there's that many on the voting rolls, you should be easily able to find out how many of them actually voted and prosecute them. Like, that happens when people vote that aren't supposed to vote. They get severe consequences.
Yes.
Unless you're, like, a Republican and you did it, like...
Which happened.
Which happens more often than what they're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly.
Act into law, I don't know what does. He announced that foreign adversaries have compromised American election data
and that
our election system is vulnerable to threats. I mean, that should concern every American citizen.
I'm sorry. This we have about- to just take this piece by piece. That is not what was claimed. In that insane screed in his primetime address that no one cared about, Trump essentially said that the evidence showed that Venezuela has the capability to change the voting results in their own elections, but there was no evidence in the documents that he released that Venezuela could do that to the United States. And the thing that was alleged in the text of the like so-called intelligence that he's presenting was that China considered doing an influence campaign in the United States, got and sought to publicly to access publicly available voter information, as does the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in the U.S., and probably the Israeli government and other foreign governments, because this information is available and they do intelligence. That was all that was alleged. And they didn't even think that it was worth it to fund this kind of campaign. So
every accusation is a confession.
Yes.
It's the same thing with like saying that China wanted Joe Biden or whatever. Like, I'm sorry, on balance, if you're going to say which country wanted which president more, you'd say Russia wanted Trump in 2016 more than China wanted Biden, just relatively speaking.
I mean, frankly, like, Biden is maybe a bigger China hawk than Trump. Like, if we're actually thinking about it in those terms, Biden wanted to pivot to Asia. The whole AUKUS thing was an attempt to curb China's influence in their region of the world. Trump is not as committed to that. He's back in the Middle East, baby. All right, keep going.
Concern every American citizen. This isn't about relitigating 2020. This is about making sure that people have faith in our election system. If you do not have a free and fair election, it's very difficult to maintain a constitutional republic, a government of, by, and for the people. I mean, this is basic stuff. And the president was highlighting that. Some of the findings are alarming. I mean, a lot of the Democrats who ran around breathlessly for years saying that Russia was intervening in our elections, you would think they'd be the first to step up and say, yeah, let's go investigate this and clean up voter rolls. I mean, that is part of our message on the campaign trails. We want to make sure that...
Wait, so China has people on the voter rolls? Is that what he's trying to imply?
Like, he says that they have publicly available voter roll information that they access.
That's because they wanted to do like polling to see who was... which way the election was going to go.
Right.
That's all the intelligence has ever alleged. Like, at most, they would want to do with that information. It's not to, like, change the vote totals.
Yes, and it is, but it is funny to see him, you know, attempt to try to fit Trump's pet fixation on the 2020 election into some sort of grand electoral strategy. There's another clip, we don't even have it on the sound sheet, but he said at one point in this press conference that he was optimistic about the midterm elections and then corrected himself to say enthusiastic. So I think that was a bit of an admission that they're not necessarily sure how this is going to go for them.
I do think it's a grand strategy, though, because he's just trying to do exact opposite. He's trying to take the faith out of elections. He's trying to make everybody cynical so that they can set up some kind of corrupted midterm.
Right.
States, all the states, including blue states, are doing their dead level best to ensure that federal law is complied with. What is federal law? To vote in a U.S. election, you have to be an American citizen. That's a simple thing. It's not being enforced in some of these states, and that's why Save America Act is so important. And we want to make sure that we don't have deceased persons on the voter roll. We want to make sure that in states where they're doing ballot harvesting, they're not just...
Who gives a goddamn
about the voter rolls if they don't vote? This is the sleight of hand that he's doing here. He's pretending that the voter rolls are the same thing as people
They just repeat
voting.
Voter rolls over and over again. It's like some sort of magic incantation that scares conservatives.
Yes.
Rounding these things up haphazardly, that the exact number of ballots that are printed go to the exact number of voters who are registered in these districts and not extra persons. This is what makes people, doubt the veracity of our election.
No, you are. Because the extent that those ballots are going to a dead person's mailbox, they're not being turned in. And if they're being turned in, then you have a case.
Yes.
Come to me then.
Right. I mean, and Like, there have been, I remember those instances where there were examples, it was disproportionately Republicans doing it.
And they're found out.
Yes. Yes. it's insane. And I still can't get over how they're attempting to sell this, that when Trump was in power, the election was stolen from him. When Biden was in power, Trump won easily.
You're
right. And it was a landslide, apparently, that he didn't reach 50% of the popular vote when he defeated Kamala Harris. So I don't understand. Like, he's also claiming, as a part of Trump was in this press conference, this China interference thing, that the intelligence that he was provided by members of his team, including the current John Ratcliffe, the current CIA head, who was DNI at the time and was responsible for giving him this information, that they withheld all of this from him, this shoddy intelligence about China that didn't really allege anything. And so it's you just have to believe so many different layers of bullshit to get to where Trump is, which is just it's an ego stroking exercise that he's brought the entire country along in this enterprise with him. So let's just hope that the Save America Act is not included in this, and even some of the provisions aren't inserted. I know that Tim Burch is unhappy with it being piecemeal, but this could be really bad. And I think there are a lot of Republicans that understand that this could impact them too, specifically in rural districts. In a moment, you're going to be hearing my conversation from earlier this morning with friend of the show, Trita Parsi. But first, a word from our sponsors here. As everybody knows, I became a cat mom around a year ago to two brother cats. They're very sweet. They're a bonded pair. And I've become very emotionally invested in their health and making sure that they're okay and that their coats are shiny and that they're drinking enough water and having enough fluid. And Smalls has been a real success story for me, specifically in getting them to, eat their food, but also the broth, which hydrates them so well. And, you know, we've been noticing how their fur is so soft. Their coat is so soft. They have a lot of energy. They're always playing together. And it's because Smalls' fresh, gently cooked food is made without preservatives. A balanced diet leads to less shedding, fewer hairballs, and a more silky shine for your cat friends. More of the nutrients in Smalls' food are digestible, so there's less junk that's coming out at the other end and makes it easier for you to clean up their litter box as well. Smalls' cat food leads to high protein and improved hydration. That equals strong bones and toned muscles. Cats use protein as their main energy source. More protein means more fuel and sustained energy. Forbes ranks Smalls the best overall cat food, and BuzzFeed says, "My cats went completely ballistic for this stuff." After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. And if you're spooked by commitment, you can try Smalls risk-free. They will refund you if your cat will not eat their food. That has not been a problem for me, though. And
Do you have picky cats?
They are picky, actually.
Mine are insanely picky.
One of them is very picky. He's got a lot of personality. The other one, less so.
When I have the Smalls broth, they scream at me when I'm getting it ready.
Right. The meowing. They're not big meowers, but they've been going nuts when I just approach the cabinet where it's kept. Stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts. For a limited time, because you are a Majority Report listener, get 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/majority. That's 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/majority. That's smalls.com/majority. We will put a link to this down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Again, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/majority. And lastly, I would like to thank ZocDoc for sponsoring today's episode. ZocDoc is a go-to here in this office and in my household. I was able to find my dentist through ZocDoc, and I've been bouncing around, not really liking the dentist that I'd had. You know, you move around the city too, in Brooklyn. It's like, oh, I'm not nearby this office anymore. I want to find somebody new and somebody I really like. And I have. And I found my dentist through ZocDoc. Doctor's appointments, you can put them off because it's really annoying, at least for me, to play phone tag with the doctor's offices. You know, you've got to maybe speak to some sort of robot on the phone. You've got to connect and press all these buttons. And then sometimes you got to leave a voicemail and they call you back, but you can't pick up. It's just, it's exhausting. But ZocDoc has a calendar that's laid out for you and an interface that shows how this doctor is available really soon. This doctor's available in the future. And it you can find an opening without having to say, like, dang, we're scheduling this. It has to be 3 months away, this doctor's appointment. That's ridiculous. ZocDoc shows what's available right away. ZocDoc lets you search and compare local in-network doctors, see actual appointment openings, and click to instantly book a visit. Appointments happen fast, usually within 24 to 72 hours, and you can even score same-day appointments. Your health matters, and taking care of yourself shouldn't be complicated. Find and book the right doctor with ZocDoc. Head to ZocDoc.com/majority to get started and check that appointment off your to-do list. That's ZocDoc.com/majority, ZocDoc.com/majority. We will put a link to that down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Quick break, and when we come back, you'll hear my conversation with Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute. We are back, and we are joined now by friend of the show, Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President at the Quincy Institute and publisher of the self-titled Substack newsletter, here with us to talk about the escalating war in Iran and the latest developments. Trita, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. We really value your perspective and expertise as this war on Iran continues to drag on. I want to, I did not mean to rhyme that. I wanted to start with the developments from yesterday, which is a significant escalation. The Houthis announcing a naval blockade on Saudi Arabia in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait in the Red Sea. Now, basically since Trump, you know, started this war and the Strait of Hormuz has been in large part closed due to Iran exerting their leverage, Saudi crude has been reliant on the Red Sea. But by enlisting the Houthis here, this is an escalation by Iran to block off that alternative, essentially, trade route. And this has been a consideration for them for many months, but to me it seems like another escalatory measure that is just going to drag this war on and on.
It's a very negative development. I mean, the restarting of the war is, and with that comes all of these different consequences. You're right, the Saudis have been using that pipeline that takes about 5 to 6 million barrels of oil to the Red Sea, and then from the Red Sea goes through the Gulf of Aden, and then on to the Asian markets. That is nevertheless more expensive than if it had gone through the Persian Gulf itself. It adds cost. It's also a smaller volume. The Red Sea has about 12% of the global oil flow. The Persian Gulf has 20%. You put the two of them together, you will get a much, much worse economic crunch than we saw during the first phase of this war. And even if the Saudis can ship their oil northwards and through the Suez Canal, mindful of the fact that the oil is going to Asia, it means that it has to go all around Africa before it gets there. So the cost, even if the flow resumes to a certain extent, it will be much, much more expensive. These are some of the nightmare scenarios, frankly, that were avoided in the first phase or the first attempt at war that Trump started. Now he started a second one. Without what appears to be some sort of a plan, because what we have seen for the last 10 days or so is a lot of bombings, but nothing that is particularly strategically decisive. Yes, there's been a targeting of bridges, civilian infrastructure that arguably would constitute war crimes. But many of these bridges are actually seasonal in the sense that the riverbanks under them are dry for most of the year, except for a couple of moments a year because of flooding. So it's not as if it's really impacting things as tremendously as I think perhaps the Trump administration thought. And now we also have revelation that the intelligence community has been saying to the administration that this is not going to change Iran's position in the negotiations. What is really baffling to me is that 10 days have passed and we've seen absolutely nothing from the administration that suggests that they had some sort of a plan of what the war was going to be. Now, there's a lot of buzz that there may be a major escalation this week, and perhaps we will see then whatever that plan is. But I would still suspect that it's not going to make that much of a difference. If anything, it's going to harden the Iranian position. It's going to make it even more difficult to get back to the negotiating table. And then once at the negotiating table, it's going to be even more difficult to actually get to a deal.
The hardening of the Iranian position feels inevitable at this point, given the fact that this is another instance of the administration using the ruse of diplomacy to restock or to regain their footing and then continuing to bomb Iran. And Iran's retaliation has been largely hitting the Gulf states. You got to wonder at a certain point, are the Gulf states going to revolt and say you can no longer use our bases because our civilian infrastructure is getting decimated? You mentioned the attacks on civilian infrastructure that the U.S. engaged in with Iran. Iran responded and did the same, and the desalination plants have been targeted. This is critical because this area is obviously very arid, and these desalination plants are key for the water supply for so many thousands of people.
Absolutely. And reality is also that the Iranians are far less dependent on their desalination plants than what the GCC states are. They have no other water resources. Iran has rivers and other sources. So this will be hitting them much harder. Now, many of them are very upset at Iran, of course, because at the end of the day, they say that their territory is not being used by the United States. We're seeing increasingly evidence that it is. We're seeing HIMARS being shot from Kuwaiti territory, filmed by American soldiers themselves and put on the internet. We've had analysis by international networks, France 24, for instance, that showed already in the first war, there was a lot of attacks coming from Kuwaiti territory. The Kuwaitis completely deny that. But at the same time, we're also seeing another trend. Whether these countries want the U.S. to leave or not, the U.S. is leaving, because it's moving more and more of its assets to Jordan and other places that are a little bit further away from Iran, because having them in Bahrain and in Kuwait is just too close to the Iranians and too easy of targets. So the very idea that these bases provided security for these states have just become a laughable proposition at this time. But we're also seeing that the Iranians can very effectively hit Jordan as well. And they can hit them with bases that are actually very well fortified. So again, what is the point of all of this? If you didn't have a plan that would fundamentally change things in a very short period of time, then you're just restarting a debacle. And now this time around, you do have the benefit of hindsight because you were here just a couple of months ago and then you chose to go back to it. At least the first time you could say, well, they didn't think this is going to end up happening the way it did. What did they think this time?
I mean, it's because the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding indicated that Iran won the war. And Trump sees that as intolerable for him, as do the Israelis, by the way. And we'll talk about their role here and in just a second. And the only thing that the United States feels and his administration feels they can rely on is our military dominance, which, yes, is the case, but Iran has all of these other points of leverage, including, the depth of its coastline, where it can hide some of the mobile launchers. They can move them around. It's very difficult to find. It's a country with a lot of, geographic advantages, including over the Strait of Hormuz. And the fact that it did reach this Jordanian base and killed their attacks, I should say, I think it was a missile strike, if I remember reading correctly, in Jordan, where two soldiers were killed. That speaks to what you're saying. They can reach Jordan. And it also appears like Iran is moving from striking just military infrastructure to striking the housing of U.S. personnel. And that might be why those two soldiers were killed.
Yeah, and that followed, by the way, that the U.S. side bombed barracks inside of Iran and killed a lot of soldiers that were asleep at the time. So we're seeing a tit-for-tat. So far, I've not seen the Iranians do anything that is going beyond responding to what the U.S. has done. So, for instance, we're not seeing what they said earlier on. Earlier on, prior to the collapse of the MOU, at one point the Iranians said that if there's any more attacks by the U.S., Iran is going to respond with a level of 1.5. In many ways, they responded with a level of 5.0, actually. But that's not what they're doing now or saying now. They're saying they're just doing tit-for-tats. And so is the U.S. by and large, except for one statement from Trump. But there's something else about the Jordanian attack that I think may have been missed by the mainstream media, which is this appears to have been somewhat different. We knew that the Iranians could reach Jordan because they can reach Israel. We knew that they could go through all of Israel's air defense systems, and they certainly can do that with the Jordanians as well. But this was apparently movement that had happened at that base, and almost immediately the Iranians found out and they struck and took the U.S. by significant surprise. The reason why this is important is because in the past, it appears the Iranians were buying commercial satellite pictures from Chinese companies, got much better accuracy, but those images may have been 5 days, 8 days, 10 days old. This intelligence that the Iranians had about that base appears to have been more or less real time. And that may either mean that they have informants on the ground. It may mean that they're actually getting much better live intelligence, real-time intelligence from the Chinese or from Russians or others. But something has changed. And I think this is probably something that is causing a lot of pause in the U.S. military right now.
That's fascinating, because the fact that they would have this intelligence is important to, you know, I guess understanding, too, what the... What forces are happening, I guess, behind the scenes that are that have their own agendas? Because we talk a lot about Israel's role here, and maybe that's a good place to turn. Just because this morning another development as well was Smotrich, their far right finance minister, had this quote this morning, and he basically controls the West Bank at this point. He had this quote talking about how Israel has no interest in joining the war, but the current situation is the best for us, essentially saying that the U.S. engaging in this war without Israel is perfect. They get to destabilize Iran, they get to destabilize the whole region, and that's better for Israeli expansionist aims and their attempt to dominate the region. But this is incredibly arrogant, in my view, because Iran has already demonstrated the capability of striking Israel.
Certainly, but by Israel not being a participant in this war, the Iranians are currently not striking Israel. So what you have is a scenario in which the United States, in its infinite wisdom, has dragged itself into another endless war in which there isn't any military solution, but there is also an increasingly narrow path towards diplomatic de-escalation because we keep on blowing up those exit ramps. And this, so Smotrich is honest. I mean, this is one of the benefits with having people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, et cetera, in the Israeli government. They've always pursued more or less the same policy, but they haven't had people that were so honest and frank about spelling it out in such clear language. Instead, there were all these different statements that made it look as if their preferences were somewhere else. But he's making it very clear. This is perfect. The United States and Iran is involved in some sort of endless war that has no exit. Fantastic. We in Israel love it. That is their perspective. And Smotrich is being very honest about it. And from their standpoint, it means that Iran will be consumed in this war with the United States. There will be no quick exit out of it. The Israelis don't have to worry about a diplomatic off-ramp. And in the meantime, they can keep on pushing the United States to go along with Israel's designs in Gaza, in West Bank, and now increasingly Lebanon, in which the U.S., Israel, and the Lebanese government are essentially pushing for a Lebanese civil war.
And I remembered actually what I wanted to ask you, a follow-up on the previous answer, because I think you mentioned China and the other geopolitical actors that have interests here. It would be significant in terms of an escalatory step for China to be like coordinating with Iran on strikes on U.S. bases. It doesn't seem likely that they're going to be doing that. But if they're engaging in intelligence sharing, that's a way to keep the United States bogged down in the Middle East and prevent the pivot to Asia that Obama and more liberal types had, and some neocons as well, had been trying to get the United States, or East Asia rather, to do for a while instead of getting bogged down in the Middle East. If China wants to maintain its dominance in its backyard, as you say, then this makes sense for them to be at least doing some intelligence sharing.
Yes, and I think it's important to recognize at the same time, despite the fact that we can make the argument that the Chinese have some benefits from this, there's people in China that also would say, look, their economy is suffering. They're far more reliant on Persian Gulf oil than what the United States is. It's impacting their neighbors in the region, even more so than China. China has far greater reserves, capacity to shift over to green technology and energy, etc. But nevertheless, their economy will suffer from the economy of their neighbors suffering as well. So they have a lot of problems, and ultimately they want stability. But despite the fact that one at the same time can make an argument, it doesn't hurt them that the U.S. is shooting itself in the foot. We've never seen the Chinese ever do anything to actually push the United States in this direction. So yes, they may be happy that at least of some aspects of this, but they're not doing much. So in that context, do we have clear evidence that the Chinese are providing intelligence? We don't. Do we have suspicions and some basis for it? Yes, but it could also be the Russians. And in some ways, the Russians may actually be more capable, given the territory that we're talking about, of being able to provide that. And the Russians certainly would have far less hesitations about sharing that information. The key conclusion for us is, why are we putting ourselves in these positions over and over again? Ultimately, they couldn't do any of these things had it not been for the United States putting itself once again in this position.
I guess that's my question for you then. I'll turn that, to make sense of such insanity, you're the one that has a lot more expertise than myself. Why are we doing this except for the reason I said earlier, that Trump is swayed by our military dominance and thinks that he can bomb his way out of a humiliation?
I think there's a couple of factors, and it's not entirely clear to me which one necessarily is the most important one or if it's an exhaustive list. But I think for Trump, this was tricky from the outset because he now, once he went to the direction of diplomacy, he had to take a fight with the Israelis and with his pro-Israeli donors, which are, of course, extremely important, and particularly Miriam Adelson. For it to be worth it for him, he needed to have this constant assembly line of good news coming from the negotiations. Diplomacy had to constantly produce something he could cling on to justify having to take this fight with Israelis and the pro-Israel donors. And reality, diplomacy with Iran or with any country that the U.S. has been at odds with for 47 years and who the U.S. just have attacked three times in the last year, was never going to be easy, and it never was going to be a straight line, and it never was going to be a straight assembly line of good news. It was just not going to be the case. But he doesn't seem to have the patience to be able to stick to one line unless he gets that positive feedback all the time. So we've seen him go towards war and then make a 180 towards diplomacy, and now he's doing another 180 towards war. And at some point, he will probably try to do a 180 towards diplomacy again. So that type of a path dependency that at some point, it's good to have some of it at least, he doesn't have it. And I think he makes these impulsive decisions that doesn't seem to have been particularly well thought through, because if they were, we should have seen something happening by now, and we're not. So I think this is also then having a second effect, which is now the Iranians are increasingly convinced that even if Trump genuinely wants diplomacy down the road, he's just not capable of seeing diplomacy succeed because he doesn't have the discipline or the patience for it.
And they probably also came to that assessment based on that widely reported, I think it was Drop Site, psychological profile that they had their intelligence officials kind of put together about Trump. And they kind of determined that, yeah, he's pretty crazy. He is a real loose cannon. And, another question I have for you is about the negotiating team as well, because the Iranians, I think, rightly are suspicious that Jared Kushner is essentially funneling all of this information directly back to Benjamin Netanyahu, and Witkoff is a real estate buddy who seems to not even understand the fundamentals of, what is even being negotiated as it relates to the Iranian nuclear program. They're incompetent as well, and that feels like a big part of the story.
I think this, I mean, there certainly is a part of the story that when it comes to nuclear expertise, Witkoff and Kushner clearly do not have that. There is this rather comical scene in the Geneva negotiations in which at one point they actually had to go to the head of the IAEA to come into the room and explain some of these, you know, some fundamentals of nuclear physics to Kushner and Witkoff, who thought that the Iranian proposal was some sort of a devious scheme, whereas in reality it was very straightforward if you understood just the fundamentals of nuclear physics and nuclear energy. So you definitely have that issue, but I think there's a different, real, deeper problem here. Yes, I'm sure they have their issues with Kushner in particular, and I think this is kind of like the frontline story. But the behind-the-scenes story that I think in some ways is more important is that they're looking for someone who can deliver Trump, someone who can negotiate on behalf of Trump. And if he at the negotiating table says, yes, Trump will accept this, the Iranians can buy it. Kushner and Witkoff said to the Iranians in Geneva back in February that they think that Trump is going to be very happy with this proposal. They went back, and it turned out that he had already made up his mind he wanted to go to war. It's part of the reason why the Omani foreign minister, who was mediating this deal, flew to Washington, hoping to see Trump. Trump never saw him. Instead, he had to have a meeting with the vice president. But this was a last-ditch desperate effort to try to make sure that this deal would, the deal that they had negotiated back then would have been accepted. What this did is that the Iranians were no longer trusting, not necessarily that because of Kushner being too close to Netanyahu or anything like that, that may also be factors. But the most important factor was they can't deliver Trump. Their word at the negotiating table is not authoritative. And by the way, look, the American side has similar question marks, if not problems, with some of the Iranian negotiators. There was a negotiation taking place in Muscat right before this war, in which there was a joint statement that the foreign minister essentially had negotiated. He took it back to Tehran over phone, and he got it nixed. And it really surprised the Omanis and the American side, and they started to ask themselves, you know, is the Iranian negotiating team sufficiently authoritative, or are they going to keep on getting overruled by the IRGC?
I mean, it's it seems like someone needs to get in the room with Trump. Like, yeah. I mean, this has been a through line with his personality, is that people say if you the last person who he's in the room with, he can agree with him. And we saw how Zoran Mamdani charmed him. Like, is it fair to assume that some forces, perhaps the Israelis, are happy if Trump is not in the room with negotiators and having these go-betweens kind of muck up the negotiation process, essentially?
I think the Israelis would be terrified if Trump actually had direct talks with the Iranians himself, or if the Iranians agreed to meet with Trump. I think the track record shows that, yes, you have an easier time actually getting a deal. You can get through a lot of the nonsense by talking directly to Trump. But the question is such a deal durable? Because Trump tends to change his mind afterwards as well. There's an example of how the Brazilian president, Lula, ran into Trump at the UN, gave him a hug. They had a very warm chat. At the time, Trump was going to impose all kinds of tariffs on Lula and was very negative towards Lula because of his support for Bolsonaro. But because of that hug, you know, Trump was just, you know, in love, at least for 15 minutes.
And I mean, Lula is an alpha male, so he is drawn to that kind of thing, yeah.
He went off script at the UN when he gave his address, kept on praising Lula and how awesome their relationship was. And for at least a couple of months, if not a full year, relations between Brazil and the United States are actually pretty much the opposite of what a lot of people expected because that one interaction. And as you recall, Trump also then invited Lula to come to Washington, which was a shocker, given the tremendous support he's given to Bolsonaro. But now Trump is back to supporting Bolsonaro. So whatever you gain, it's just temporary at the end of the day. And that, again, is raising question marks on the Iranian side, because many of the concessions they would give to get a deal would probably be permanent concessions, are not things that they can just get back once Trump once again changes his mind.
I'm also reminded of how, you know, Claudia Sheinbaum, he was talking pretty tough, and she ended up charming him as well. Something about these leftists, they kind of know what they're doing. Just a question or two more that I wanted to hit on. You mentioned southern Lebanon. Israel is continuing to just steal land in southern Lebanon, and that has been that was a part of the memorandum of understanding, and it was supposed to be folded into the negotiations, and Iran was trying to hold on to, you know, Hezbollah and link arms with them. What is the status of Lebanon as it relates to the diplomacy?
Yeah, the status of Lebanon right now is that in the MOU, there was an agreement that there had to be a region-wide ceasefire, and the United States actually started putting real pressure on the Israelis to stop attacking. At a minimum, they had stopped their attacks on Beirut. You also saw a lot of criticism by Trump publicly criticizing how the Israelis were conducting it, saying, you know, just because you need to take out a Hezbollah person, you don't have to take down an entire apartment with 500 people in it. Mm. You had J.D. Vance go publicly and say the Israelis cannot kill themselves out of every problem. So there was a real offensive against the Israelis to hold up that MOU. But then Marco Rubio goes to the region. He does a thing with the GCC, and then he goes and he negotiates this deal between Israel and the Lebanese government that really contradicts the MOU. The MOU says that Israel has to leave Lebanese territory. It doesn't use that as exact language, talk about Lebanon's sovereignty, but it was well understood what it meant. But the MOU then says, no, sorry, the Israeli-Lebanese government that Rubio is mediating says, no, Israel will leave once Hezbollah has been disarmed. Disarming Hezbollah will either require a massive war or a civil war. It's just not something that can be achieved that easily. But that also then changes the time frame fundamentally. We're talking about the years, perhaps, if it is achievable at all. So it completely undermined the MOU, and is part of the reason why increasingly the MOU ended up becoming an empty agreement, because the U.S. kept on doing other things on the side that was in contradiction to it, including the attempt to kind of fortify a southern channel in the Persian Gulf, in the Straits. So now you have a situation in which the Lebanese government is working together with Israel, treating Hezbollah as if it's some sort of a joint Lebanese-Israeli problem, and even toying with the idea of bringing in the former head of al-Qaeda in Syria, who's now the president of Syria, to join them in fighting Hezbollah, which essentially is what I said earlier on in the program. This is a design to push Lebanon towards a civil war. And it's just absolutely disastrous. I can understand why the Israelis are terribly happy about it. And it would be devastating for them if the MOU actually had been implemented, because it would have pushed the Israelis out of Lebanon.
We should also note that Israel's been bombing Gaza essentially every day since the so-called ceasefire. But it feels like, you know, we're getting reports every day, 3 children killed, 4 children killed. I mean, Hamas has been really decimated at this point. And my question to you is how Gaza fits into these negotiations.
Gaza really didn't end up fitting into these negotiations, which I assume is because the Iranians simply didn't have the leverage to make demands on Gaza as well, because it was hard enough for the U.S. to push back against Israel in Lebanon, and that ended up not being particularly long-lasting, because you have people in the administration who were completely opposed to the idea of putting any pressure on Israel. But the idea of Trump being able to push the Israelis both on Lebanon and on Gaza was clearly beyond the reach of the Iranians. If they had the leverage, I'm pretty confident they would have at least tried. And there were statements coming out of the IRGC that says that Gaza is no different from Lebanon. But at the end of the day, in the real negotiations, there was a huge difference between the two. And I think it's also important to understand that for the Iranians, Lebanon and resurrecting what they call their forward defense is their first line of defense against Israel. It is what prevented Israel from attacking Iran in 2006, because Israel didn't manage to defeat Hezbollah in 2006. Gaza has never played that role in the Iranian security outlook. So as a result, despite the ideological arguments the Iranian government would put forward, in which, you know, Gaza is perhaps even more important than Lebanon, from a secure standpoint, it never has been. And ultimately, despite the Iranian rhetoric, ideology is not the driving force of their foreign policy.
And this has been the case, tragically for the people of Gaza, with other countries in the region that should, you know, their population is supportive of the Palestinian cause, and yet it's not worth it for them to protect these people who are essentially in an open air concentration camp.
Well, so, in the case of many of the other Arab governments, I think, to be fair, they're actually helping the Israelis.
So right. They're paid off. Yes, yes. Yeah, exactly. They're paid off, too, by the U.S. Lastly, what do we know about Kurdish proxies on the Iraqi border that, you know, it seems like Trump was trying to arm the Kurds and the Israelis were trying to arm the Kurds at the start of this war? Where have we heard this before? What's the status?
The status is, I mean, first of all, what happened in January was that there was an attempt during February for them to actually be the ground troops. It didn't work, partly because the Turks intervened, but also because the Iraqi government intervened, the Kurdish government in Iraq, because they knew very well this was going to end up very badly and that Iraqi Kurdistan would pay for it. So they put a stop to it. I'm sure there are still some attempts to make it happen. And if it's not the Kurds, it might be some other ethnic minorities, the Baluchis or others that would be used. All of these in these type of desperate efforts to try to win some sort of a military victory that clearly is not in the cards. And this is what ultimately can lead to these type of conflicts becoming endless, which is an unattainable objective and zero political will to shift towards something else, towards some sort of an exit. Instead, it's just easier to pour more and more resources into trying to achieve something you know is unachievable.
Well, Trita Parsi, appreciate you giving us the rundown here on yet another endless war in the middle. Well, I guess this is in adjacent, another endless war that that Trump has dragged us into. Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and you should check out Trita's Substack newsletter, Trita Parsi, to follow all of the latest developments on this war. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it.
We are back. Brian just counted out of order. 5, 4, 2, 3. That's not how it goes, buddy.
Yeah, says you.
Yeah, I guess.
You didn't go to high school in the Atlanta area.
I did not learn special math, which is the special math that caused Trump to lose Georgia in 2020. That's
exactly
why they didn't count it correctly.
You trust those guys to count down there?
Yeah, exactly. Matt, what is happening in the Matt Luckian media universe?
Left Reckoning coming up right after the show today on YouTube and Twitch. We talk about this Jasmine Crockett, James Tallarico, continuing meltdown that's going on that hopefully won't be a huge problem in trying to beat a Republican in that.
Seems state. Pretty bad. What
seems
is she doing?
Little...
Wrecking.
Yeah, I mean, what...
For narcissistic reasons, because of a Netflix documentary or something?
Well, that Netflix documentary also looks a bit... I mean, her district got more blue.
She's lying. She's lying about what happened.
Yeah, I mean, just she's lying about her Israel record, which was... I didn't take AIPAC money, which was true, but you did take a trip paid by AIPAC's education arm to go to Israel and pose in front of the Iron Dome, and also voted to defund UNRWA. But anyway, Jasmine Crockett hopefully won't spoil that election with, campaign of narcissism.
Yes, it's so important. Can you imagine if a leftist, an actual leftist, was trying to wreck a key Senate race the way she's trying to wreck a key Senate race based on nothing?
One of the demands are like, I should personally get more respect. But anyway, that coming up after the show today. We also talk about Bhaskar Sankara on... with the New York Times and Russ's Douthat. New York Times is Ross Douthat. and play an old Michael Brooks clip that is linked to both of the stories that we talk about there. So patreon.com/leftreckoning coming up right after the show today.
Yes. All right. And as we mentioned yesterday was the 6-year anniversary of Michael Brooks's passing. We thinking of him a lot yesterday. I'm thinking about him a lot today. So, you know, that was probably really cool, you know, addition to the Left Reckoning episode. Everybody should check it out ASAP.
Definitely influenced David and I's mood in discussing the Texas race.
Okay.
Particularly
in that you didn't hold back?
Yeah, and certain types of appeals that are cynical and need to be seen through.
Yep. As a reminder, this show relies on your support. Join themajorityreport.com. Become a member if you can. It would be helpful. You can IM the show. We sometimes read your IMs on air. We'll read some IMs in the fun half. Anything else? All right. See you in the fun half.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the Majority Report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
Yeah, I think you need to take over for Sam.
Yes, please.
No. I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why.
She was offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
That's what we call the biz.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Right.
Tour, sushi, and poker.
We're gonna get demonetized.
I just think that what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Well, look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about it. I think you're responsible.
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Tour,
wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind.
So it's offered a tour?
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Tour, sushi and poker with the boys. Boy.
Tour, I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a kid. Tour, I think I'm like a little kid.
Had this debate 7,000 times.
A little kid. I think I'm like a little kid. Think I'm like a kid.
Tour, I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing meat. With a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here.
Okay, all right. It's not a fun job.
Tour?
That's a real thing. That's real thing.
Willy Wonka
tour? That's a real thing. That's real thing.
What's that offered a tour?
That's a real thing. That's real thing.
That's
a tour?
A real thing.
That's real thing.
What's that offered a tour?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered a tour?
That's a real thing.
That's poker with
he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's
poker with the boys.
That offered a tour?
That's a real thing.
That's
poker.
Let's go, Joey.
Tour? Sushi and poker with the boys.
Take it easy, Glenn.
Tour? Sushi and poker.
Things have really gotten out of hand.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Delusional.
Tour?
Deluded.
Sushi.
You don't have a clue as to what's going on. Live YouTube.
Sam has like the weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you. You were happy.
Let's change the subject.
Right. Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's
now,
one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is a pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump. Violet.
Twerk.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't bitch. The way Emma has cucked all of these people.
Love it.
That's where my heart is, so I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh, you wrote an honors thesis.
Yeah.
I guess I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of the foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I don't have an answer to.
Incredible theme song.
I Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like, period.
We are back. It is the fun half of the Majority Report, folks. Camera's being a little choppy today, so I'm down at, you know, a nice 480p here. We'll see if that corrects itself at all. In 2026.
25 years ago, that would be cutting edge work. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Vaughn from Wisconsin. Was Crockett's bleach blonde, bad-built butch body her most meaningful contribution to politics?
Yeah.
I did enjoy that.
That stuff was fine. Not to say it was the most substantive.
Yeah, no. I mean,
input.
It's... No.
It was based... It was purely performative. Like, a lot.
Yeah. Science is political. Wait, Jasmine Crockett still won't vote blue no matter who. Yep.
Jasmine Crockett has a great theory that she's going to help the down ballot races so much that it's going to help the top of the ticket, even though she doesn't want to endorse the top of the ticket and is making a concerted effort not to. And I'm just saying, like, Ken Paxton loves that. That's
of
the
course.
That's the where I, as far as I'm concerned, where the conversation begins and ends, and there's no time for it.
Except
on Left Reckoning after the show.
Yeah. Hey Trey, we love you, Emma and crew. Appreciate that. Snark and Norsky, between increased fertilizer and fuel prices, lost trade markets, and the drought, a lot of small farms are going to go bankrupt this year. Anecdotally, my spouse has had farmers break down crying in her office when discussing this year's crop and their financial situation.
That's the whole point.
Yep.
Awful. Jay Tingle, W. Bush already invented voter fraud over 20 years ago. Republican voters know it's bullshit. They just like Republican politicians who spout the bullshit on TV and provide their false premise to prevent specific groups from exercising their franchise rights. That's true.
It is rich, like, hearing people. They think they care about foreign influence in elections or, indeed, like, making sure all the votes are counted correctly when we live in a world that where the 2000 election happened and the 2020 thing where they tried to falsify electors. Like,
yeah, it's kind of an issue. You want to play this?
Yeah, so there's a new piece in the New Yorker that I think is worth discussing about a woman named Deborah Lipstadt, who was the special envoy for anti-Semitism under Joe Biden, an office that I think has been mainly concerned with Israel's interests than actual, like, fighting anti-Semitism. Here is Deborah Lipstadt after the beeper attack in Lebanon, making a joke about that, which was a war crime.
Throwing stones from outside window, and they hit his mother, which is...
There's a new Twitter thing where they're auto-playing videos, and it is making it difficult to not make sure other things play. So here it is.
Got another great update from Elon Musk's Twitter.
After October 7th, there was a feeling around the world that Israel is weaker. And
You want a beeper?
Now, that lady was the person that the Democrats put in charge of fighting anti-Semitism. But she also had a larger role that's being reported on by the New Yorker now. She's included here. That month, this is about weighing about policy. So last month, at least 8 State Department bureaus, agencies, or missions sent in assessments that Blinken had requested for his required review of Israel's conduct required by law. At least 5 argued that Israel had likely used U.S. weapons in violation of the laws of war and had impeded the delivery of U.S. humanitarian aid. Official told me that Barbara Leaf, the Assistant Secretary of the State for Near Eastern Affairs, agreed. On the other side, Jacob Lew, the American ambassador to Jerusalem and Israel's principal defender within the Biden administration, argued that Israel was complying with the relevant military laws. The Political Military Bureau, which oversees weapon sales, concluded that Israel had not committed violations with U.S. weapons.
Huh.
Deborah Lipstadt, the special envoy for combating anti-Semitism, urged against holding the Jewish state to a higher standard than other countries, but she stopped short of claiming expertise in warfare or aid distribution. Why is she involved in this discussion at all?
I mean, yeah, it's a good question.
This is the same thing happened with Sean Fain and Neil Barofsky. Sean Fain, the UAW president, who after the UAW came out in support of a ceasefire, righteously, Neil Barofsky got on the phone and with another former, I think it was the special envoy for anti-Semitism under Obama, said, hey, be nicer to Israel when you tell them to, when you call for a ceasefire. This is inappropriate. This is how this happened. It's people like this that we listen to and shouldn't.
Jake Sullivan is now attempting to kind of, reclaim his legacy here. And we can't allow it because we knew that Benjamin Netanyahu even told Biden that they were using the starvation campaign, for example.
Or he told Zelensky, I think, is what I saw.
Or he told Zelensky, gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Okay, maybe it wasn't. But I mean, come on. This was knowledge within the administration, and they were fudging our own reports to make it so that it wasn't obvious that we were, committing genocide and violating international
law. But, how could this be? It says, the required review of Israel's conduct, which is required by our laws, saying, hey, let's not arm people who are committing war crimes. And now all of a sudden we got, what, the special envoy for anti-Semitism who herself admits she doesn't know shit about war, but will go up on stage and make a beeper joke. Like, she gets to weigh in on this?
Yeah.
This is wholly inappropriate.
Sickle up economy. To paraphrase dead Republican Colin Powell, it's not anti-Semitic to say F Israel. Lowercase a, they called us sexist, but Hassan told his chat to stop calling Haley Stevens John Fetterwoman, so I think we deserve some grace there. They're making up the sexism stuff. Space Lennon, is Sam coming back? Yes, he's coming back. He's not... Well, we shall see. He will be back. Vaughn from Wisconsin, was Crockett... I already read that. Pope Pax, do you think it's weird for Tim to be that his best song featuring his vocals is the MR Fun Half song? I hope he knows about it for that purpose. For that reason, maybe. Okay, let's do this. How's my camera? Should I go back down to 480? Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on emotionally from it. Okay. So, right now, there is this effort from many people within Israeli society to settle the Gaza Strip now that they've destroyed almost every single building there and they've killed likely hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who are unaccounted for and presumed dead under rubble. We have very, very lagging death tolls because they are only able to verify deaths, and they use a very conservative tactic, essentially, because they've been accused of lying so many times by the West, where they will, if they can identify the body in a hospital, that's what is counted as a dead person. But we know that sometimes whole families are obliterated. Why would you bring them to the hospital to get counted as dead if that were the case, or who can bring them? And all of these people who are just missing under these carcinogenic pieces of rubble, right? I mean, like the health impacts alone, let alone the amputees, let alone the trauma. They've done so many different levels of horror, so much barbarity in Gaza that it's difficult to know where to start. But what's infuriating is that I want to put up this article here from 972 Magazine, and then we'll play this report from them. 972 writes, nearly half of Israel's government joins march vowing Gaza settlements. So this is just a reminder to people that Israeli society is in lockstep behind this genocide.
Yeah, there's not a difference between their government and their people, unlike, say, America, with regards to Israel and Palestine.
Right. And, in fact, these are protests attempting to pressure Netanyahu from the right. So I'll read a little bit here. Oren Ziv has this write-up in 972. The March of Thousands could hardly be called a demonstration or a protest. Those are actions usually taken in opposition to the government or demanding something from outside of it. But when several thousand right-wing activists marched to the Gaza fence on Sunday, calling for Israel to reestablish settlements in the Strip, they did so with the participation of almost half the government and under the auspices of the police, even though the army had declared the area a closed military zone, making it an arrestable offense to enter. The official reason for the march was to put pressure on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to advance settlement construction in Gaza, which Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich promised in June would happen as soon as the Prime Minister gives his approval. But the event also intended to demonstrate who is in charge, who stands above the law, and can get what they want, as they have already done in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, with or without the Prime Minister. The marchers, many of whom had been bussed in from settlements in the occupied West Bank, began at Zikim Beach, just north of the Gaza Strip. A few hundred meters from the beach, military police had erected a checkpoint, and soldiers with deadpan seriousness presented the participants with a closed military zone order and tried to force their vehicles to turn back. But the hordes who had arrived had no intention of giving up. They continued marching and passed from one checkpoint to the next, facing little resistance. As in previous instances, the goal was to reach a gathering point near the Gaza perimeter fence, a place where the general public is usually permitted from going. And, you know, the author here describes how the police kind of pretended to resist, but didn't necessarily actually do that. And they have examples of how the Israeli police have previously attacked left-wing activists who were trying to provide aid at the Gaza border in a very similar area. So that's what's happening right now in Israel, or outside of the Gaza Strip. This is where the fervor is. And as a reminder, nearly half of the government joined them in these demonstrations. Here is a clip of one of the most notorious settlers here, Daniela Weiss, who you can read Isaac Chotiner's interview with her in the New Yorker if you want to get a better sense of her ideology.
Did Louis Theroux also talk to her? Am I remembering that right? But or maybe it was Chotiner.
I'm not sure about Theroux, but Chotiner, I remember that interview right. Quite clearly. She makes a bunch of insane claims. But here she is, one of the prominent settler activists in Israel, speaking at this event, outside of the Gaza Strip. No Arabs in Gaza anymore. There you go.
This is what Israel is.
So this is water being given out. Almost half the Israeli government, along with thousands of right-wing activists. This was coordinated. I mean, on the other side of that fence, people are, dying and starving.
Oh yeah,
to death.
If a similar demonstration happened, as it has happened with like the March of Return. And there was Palestinians sitting down there. Israel knows how they deal with that. Yep. Shoot them.
They shot, if people recall, our Dr. Tarek Loubani, the Canadian-Palestinian physician who has been on our program multiple times, was shot in the leg during that peaceful demonstration. So the army distributed bottles and mineral water to the participants. And the police barely
gave him rides home.
Yeah. Today, there are many families that are ready right away.
Yep.
Both to cross the fence and to live there. After all, there are settlements on this side of the fence. So why can't there be settlements on the other side of the fence?
Good question.
I guess that's the question there. That must have been the West Bank, or I'm not sure which actual point that was on the Gaza Strip where they were at the fence. But either way, even just how settlers can be bused to the Gaza Strip, and Palestinians can't even drive on most roads in the West Bank, and there you see side by sides of the traffic that Palestinians before the act of genocide began had to wait through, just to go to work. And Israelis have safe passage no matter what.
It's South Africa on steroids.
Yep.
And we have to, Trita Parsi made the point that I've heard, Ilan Pape made, Israeli historian people should check out. I think I maybe heard Avi Shlaim make this point that they actually appreciate dealing with people like Ben Gavir because they're honest.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas liberal Zionists, we're like in America here. I mean, there's this video with Alex Wagner of Pod Save America talking with Abdul Sayed, and they're talking about a Jewish state. And you don't think we should care about a Jewish state? It's like, how about we actually confront the Jewish state that actually exists rather than the one that exists in the heads of liberal Zionists, the one that like respects democracy and human rights, but it still maintains a Jewish majority somehow in a land that didn't naturally have one. It's not honest. Everybody to the left of Gavir that supports Israel is to some extent lying to themselves.
Yeah. Yep. Well, let's play eight then, now that we're on the topic. Brad Lander is breaking the brains of so many Zionists because he describes himself as a liberal Zionist. I don't think this autoplay is so frustrating. I don't think that, obviously I don't agree with Lander's stance on identifying as a liberal Zionist for the reasons that we describe. Zionism is a settler colonial ideology, and his belief that Israel can be both democratic and Jewish, I think, is a false one. because it also makes it so that Palestinians have no right to return to the land that they were ethnically cleansed from. And it still it backs up this kind of belief that for some reason in this conception of Zionism or with Zionism as the ideology, that Palestinians and Israelis cannot live side by side, that there that Israel necessitates this apartheid and separation based on ethnicity and religion in a supremacist way that I think is fundamentally undemocratic and illiberal. So that is where the liberal values in liberal Zionism are contradictory.
Yeah, I perceive Lander to be on a trajectory similar to that, like travel by Avi Shlaim, another of the Israeli historians, who was a two-state solution guy for a long time until ultimately coming into reality that there's one state reality. And the question is whether that's going to be Jewish supremacist or democratic. Lander's a politician.
Yes.
So he's, I honestly don't know what he believes in his heart, exactly. But I think he's a smart guy. And I think the reality of this is something that cannot be avoided. And if it is in the future, does try to avoid it, it's going to be a problem for him electorally, just as it was for Dan Goldman. But right now he's on the correct side of things.
And he's doing much more good than he is harm by explaining Palestinian humanity and even identifying in that way might reach people that need to hear it, other so-called liberal Zionists. So who knows what is in Lander's heart.
I don't necessarily care. Yeah.
Right. I like that what he stands for is blocking both offensive and defensive weapons to Israel. And if that's the standard here for his policy, plus he supports things like Medicare for all, you know, I'm proud that Lander will be my congressman after these upcoming midterms. So I have really enjoyed him going on cable TV and breaking Zionist brains, including Dana Bash, and here Batya Unger Sargon, who I guess has a show. I didn't realize that she has a show on cable news.
Very easy brain.
Who's
break.
Like, yeah, taking a break, brain. Taking a break from being the working class whisperer who comes from like a Harvard neurologist.
Interesting.
To be a fervent Zionist, which is probably maybe more comfortable.
Was she on that show, her take? Because she has the politics of somebody that, oh, no, okay. Well, she has inscrutable politics, so it would make sense if she was on that show.
It's the same sort of scam. Of like,
yes. Yeah. I've got a new way. I've got a third way to do politics here. But, of course,
she's sort of Timu Barry Weiss.
Yeah, right. There you go. And so here she is. She had Lander on, and this is a really fascinating exchange.
Campaign with them.
You know that many, many Jews feel that Mamdani endangering the safety of Jewish workers.
We just have to get his reaction to...
He literally guffaws in her face. Oh, come on, bro.
Look at me.
You know that many, many Jews feel that Mamdani endangering the safety of Jewish New Yorkers. I hear this every
day. Believe me, I'm sure I hear it more than you. So, Jews are feeling so much fear and anxiety right now. I mean, anti-Semitism rises in times of war, in times of fascism, and we're amidst both. And you see it, I think, most dangerously on the right, but you see it on the left as well. From both, there's no doubt. From it's coming from both places.
Two people because he thought they were Jews in D.C. He chanted the same thing you chanted: "Free, free Palestine."
I mean, that's vile, yes, but there's a big difference. I mean, that was vile anti-Semitism, and I called it out the day it happened, and I try to do it every time when people graffitied the homes of the board members of the Brooklyn Museum, and I thought they were targeting them because they were Jewish, not having anything to do with policies toward Palestine. I'll call it out. But yes, I'm for a free Palestine because I don't think Israelis will be truly safe until Palestinians are free. And to me, there's just no contradiction between standing up for Palestinian human rights, as you have done. I mean, when you supported Issa Amro.
And on this very show, we're calling for people to pay attention to the protest in Gaza right now against Hamas.
okay, pause it. Give me a break. We just played a clip of Israeli settlers and almost half of the government of Israel that showed up to the Gaza border to demand that Israel settle it and steal all of the land and is trying to pressure Benjamin Netanyahu. But let's pay attention to the Palestinians protesting against Hamas, as she claims, as if people right now in Gaza who are just struggling to stay alive on a day-to-day basis, like, that is what's operational or operable here. And Hamas has been essentially decimated and forced to lay down their arms in this way. And we'll see if they resurge. But I just found that to be a very odd... it doesn't even connect to the point that he's making, but continue.
Just want Palestinians to have their own state. He believes Israel should not exist as a Jewish state.
I mean, he thinks there should be a binational state that's a state for all its citizens. That's not my point of view. I remain a liberal scientist. I believe in the vision of a...
I'm sorry. Go ahead. You're good. Well, I was gonna say, most Jews view that view as an endangerment of the Jewish Israelis who live in Israel, to ask them to basically live under a majority
with
Muslim
those people.
Rule, like give Sharia law a chance, right?
So, I mean, this is some honesty here. And
that's what I like about this clip.
Revolting of the Israeli people.
Yes. She's revealing there that it's demographic anxiety that is motivating
this
Israel's
is
apartheid.
A white panic.
White nationalism. This is no different than... Jim Crow. This is no different than
the Jim Crow,
South Africa.
Exactly. The way that white people talked about the fall of Jim Crow, I mean, the lynchings that were spurned by hysterical coverage of like black people just existing in society. This is a white panic. This is like what you saw in South Africa in the 80s.
Right. And the stuff about Hamas, too. Let's just say there were protests against Hamas that are significant enough to pay attention to. I still don't think that this is anything except a Zionist fantasy, but let's just contend that that's the case. Do you think that this would be Palestinians essentially saying that we should have no civil society or armed resistance whatsoever?
Settle us.
Yeah, please.
Because that's what's
take
on the
our
menu.
Land. Take our land. We'll just lay down and take it. That's what she's basically arguing in terms of like the implication of foregrounding protests against Hamas in that argument.
And this is why when she says here, like, you want to have one country where the Palestinians outnumber Jewish people, this is why they wanted to kill so many people after October 7th, because the demographics aren't in their favor.
Yep.
Jews I believe in
that
the vision
view...
of a...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You're good.
Well, I was going to say, most Jews view that view as an endangerment of the Jewish Israelis who live in Israel, to ask them to basically live under a majority Muslim rule, like to give Sharia law a chance, right? Most Jews feel that the view that Israel should be a binational state is to endanger
racist.
The lives of 8 million Jews.
Also, I'm sorry. The idea that it would be Sharia law rule, that there are secular Palestinian organizations and there has been secular Palestinian resistance that Israel has
PLO?
Undercut. Yes.
Remember those guys?
Because they want it to be this like scary Islamophobic trope that the Islamists are going to take over and make everybody live under Sharia law. There's something called a multiracial democracy that Muslim people can exist in too. They exist in it here in the United States, as do Jews.
This is actually like part of the Cold War is supported Israel and also attacked all of the sort of communist or left-leaning movements throughout the Arab world and left these radical religious fundamentalist groups.
That's how the Taliban got started.
Yep, exactly. Remember the PLO? They were spoken about the exact same way Zionists speak about Hamas, is they just want to bomb us. They don't want to let us exist. How dare you even ask us to sit down with them?
That Israel should be a binational state is to endanger the lives of 8 million Jews.
I mean, there are many Jewish anti-Zionists who also believe in the vision of a binational state. Albert Einstein, who they asked to be the president of Israel, had concerns that sovereignty wouldn't work well. This is a debate to have. I disagree with the mayor on this point, but I do not believe that he is endangering the lives of Jews. Here in New York City, he kept Jesse Tisch honest police commissioner. He grew the funding for the mayor's office to combat anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. How Israelis and Palestinians are going to learn to live together. And whether that's as I think you and I think it should be, is in two states that each, you know, Israel with a majority of Jews, but protecting the full equal rights of its Palestinian citizens, and a Palestine with a majority of Palestinians, but there'll be some settler, minority Jewish members there. That makes sense to me, but there's people...
Does Batya agree with that, though? Like, whether or not that's realistic, which I obviously we don't agree that it is.
The 700,000 illegal Israeli settlers in the West Bank are going to get folded into the Palestinian state. Good luck, Brad.
It's clear the South Africa solution is the correct one here. But does Batya agree with him, even, that Palestine should get a state? Because most Israelis do not.
They don't.
Because... Like, even the moderate folks say, like, don't look at me. I've never said the words Palestinian state.
Yes. And someone writes in, Uday Kusei Lotnik, why did he keep Tish? Because I think Mamdani recognized that getting his affordability agenda was going to be a big enough. It's the same reason that they didn't challenge Jeffries this time around. Mamdani wanted to not fight a war on every front, and going to war with the police commissioner and police union as you're trying to get your affordability agenda across. Plus, same thing with Jeffries, when you would need his buy-in, would have been too tall of a task. So you save those fights for another day.
It's a purely like the political capital. I mean, I think it was possible maybe immediately, but also crime is low. If all of a sudden you fire her and there's an uptick in it, you create a problem with yourself. And also, the NYPD isn't particularly under control right now.
Right. And so that's a bit of an aside here. But and it was also a way to try to defang some of these Zionist arguments against him. Not that Batya Angar-Sargon is taking the bait there. But yeah, these questions have to be asked. With the, say you support a two-state solution, okay, so then you support full statehood, right, for Palestinians. They would say yes.
They can have a military and like an airport and stuff, right?
Right. That would necessitate them having a military and an ability for them to defend themselves in the same way that Israel does, and that is why the two-state solution people, for the most part, outside of well-meaning people like Brad Lander, don't actually mean it. It would also, in my view, necessitate the removal of 700,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which Lander seems to think that they would be okay just, you know, getting folded into Palestine and being minorities there. I disagree, buddy.
It'll take a little bit of political education for that.
Yes, too. But again, what he's doing is a lot more helpful than it is harmful.
Because he's sticking to principles that are actually
right,
more important than whether there's a Jewish state in the Mediterranean.
Yep.
The fully equal rights of its Palestinian citizens and a Palestine with a majority of Palestinians, but there'll be some settler, minority Jewish members there. That makes sense to me, but there's people promoting a binational state or confederation. Palestinians and Israelis are going to have to sit down at the table and figure this out. And by calling for change to end a system that, look, I do think is essentially apartheid, that's not anti-Semitism, that's politics.
Yes. God, I love how soft his voice is, too, as he says these things. It's disarming for them.
I mean, this is why, I think it Zohran Mamdani's rephrase that Abdullah Sayed has also picked up on. Like, do you agree that, first of all, it was never asked this way, 20 years ago. Like, do you agree Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state? The reason they add as a Jewish state now is because it stopped the pretense of existing as a democracy for the exact reasons Batya is talking about, is they're outnumbered.
Yep.
And they want to have a majority Jewish government and populace.
Exactly. Some guy, do I understand this correctly? Israeli settlers who stole land from Palestinians are afraid they won't be safe in Palestine until they eliminate all the Palestinians? Pretty much. Cauliflower, controlling the NYPD might require a federal government with a Democratic president willing to use federal agencies for an investigation. Mamdani just may not have enough power given how crazy that particular institution is. I think that's a fair assessment.
Look, I think I don't think people are wrong to have criticisms of I just blanked on her name again.
Jessica Tisch.
But I do think it's more of like a final boss more than the one you wanted to take on at the very beginning of your administration. I just think that's reality, especially when you got a president like Trump and Stephen Miller and stuff who will use any opportunity to try to bully with the feds.
Zohran is probably also calculating that he needs her and needs NYPD collaboration if they're going to combat any ICE operations in the city.
Hopefully that doesn't become a problem with collaboration.
Biding My Time says, Bradlander's tone and cadence is so unique. Absolutely unmistakable. I know.
It's so great that he's going to be a congressman.
It's hilarious, yes. It's very sing-songy in a way that's fun to me. I will miss Haley Stevens' cadence if all goes well.
But he does have, like, this sort of vibe of, like, someone, like, who's, like, a crisis mediator. Like, mm-hmm. like you're having a tough time right now. You're yes. clearly freaking out. Yeah. Let's just talk about it.
Right. He really, I mean, he's, like, the one male therapist I would actually go to and feel safe with. Lowercase A said, they call us sexist, but Hassan, oh, I already read that. Hollywood Hugo, I just want to reassure everyone that Sam is in good spirits after an unfortunate confrontation with a Crunchwrap Supreme. Let's be honest, it was more than one. Sam has been spending most of his time holding on to his most cherished loved one, his Hello Toshiba Day. Thank you, Hollywood Hugo, for that visual. Very appreciated.
Visual, yeah.
Yes. Maddie Moore on Hamas dissolved their government to try to force the Board of Peace to actually bring in the technocratic governance body. I mean, they need infrastructure. But Maddie Moron says neither Hamas nor PIJ called for Sharia law in Palestinian state. Yeah, it's just racism.
Yeah.
Amicular. Emma's looks maxing like clavicular. Also, not a single prominent Zionist voice spoke up about protecting the Jewish women assaulted by the Zionist mob in Brooklyn last year.
No.
Exactly.
I mean, the truth is, like, whether, like, Batya says, like, all Jews consider this a threat to the Israelis or whatever, like, I'd like to see polling on that, but the truth is, as far as, like, spokespeople that are respectable, it's the same thing with, like, most white people who come from Catholic backgrounds support, like, anti-abortion stuff, but put any of them in front of a camera, and I'm sorry, like, they're clearly bad people.
Yeah.
And I mean, in terms of, like, the professional media people, so what if, like, a lot of my family has that position? Like, when you actually sit down and make it your policy, it is horrendous.
Yeah. Let's do three here. So there are a few different stock trading bills that are floating around the House and the Senate. Of course, Josh Hawley with his faux populism has the Pelosi Act, pretending like, you know, look, Nancy Pelosi has enriched herself in indefensible ways as a member of Congress, but
yeah,
Trump is made $2 billion from crypto last year.
Yeah.
Give me a break. And crypto is going to come into play in this conversation. So the one that has over 100 bipartisan co-sponsors that, you know, AOC and Pramila Jayapal are supportive of is the Restore Trust in Congress Act. This bans members of Congress and their immediate families from trading stocks, individual stocks, and it gives a framework for members to divest from their stock portfolio. Now, this Republican, Brian Steele, has introduced an alternative version, which Republican leadership is quietly backing. You can probably guess that this bill doesn't have the same amount of teeth. AOC and Pramila Jayapal put out a statement about this because they say that this bill that this Republican is proposing allows you to keep individual stocks, which seems like the entirety of the debate here. It means so they don't have to divest, which means they could continue profiting as these stocks appreciate.
I got heavily invested in the
right.
General Dynamics before I got into office here.
Yes, like what a coincidence. And it means that they wouldn't be incentivized to purchase new stocks, but they would be able to enrich themselves by, say, giving out fat contracts to the companies that they're already invested in.
Like AI companies, for instance.
Right, right. They've been critical of this bill, obviously. Here is Representative Joe Neguse of Colorado grilling Representative Brian Steele on this bill and why it doesn't include all of these things, including crypto holdings and prediction markets being, you know, mysteriously left out of this Republican-backed bill.
Philippa, you today are allowed to buy crypto if you so chose.
It's not a trick question. You're allowed to.
That's what I'm saying.
Individual placements. Because someone else referenced this previously, that there, can you do individual purchase of individual placements of stock under this?
Individual shares of stock, no.
Individual shares, no. Private placements, yes.
Right. The current House rules would apply.
Correct. Okay.
Right.
So if it's easier, I'll frame it that way. I'll use
the current House rules apply.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
But what I want to make clear to people who are listening is
sure.
There are significant restrictions in place under House rules. I wouldn't want somebody to walk away and think
fine.
That no other rules apply.
Okay.
I want to make sure that they're clear that
let's
current
use
House
your
rules
language.
Apply.
Let's use your language.
Yeah, I think it's more accurate.
Under current House rules, members of Congress can buy crypto holdings. And under your bill, that does not change, right?
There's no change.
Okay.
Made.
And under current House rules, members of Congress can buy stocks through private placements. And under your bill, that does not change, right?
No change.
Okay.
No.
And under current House rules, members of Congress can buy stocks, can buy industry-specific mutual funds, right?
That's accurate.
And that does not change under your bill.
It's not changed.
Okay. And under current House rules, members of Congress can buy bonds, right?
Mm-hmm.
And under your bill, that does not change.
You still buy bonds.
And there are countless other pieces of legislation that members of Congress have introduced, myself included, that would ban all of what I just described. That is the point. I would say, with respect to Mr. Morelli's comment about the prediction markets, I do not understand, and perhaps you can illuminate this for me. The House Administration Committee has jurisdiction over member participation in prediction markets,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's accurate.
Okay, you're the chair.
Along with others, but yes.
But
we're one of them.
You've got principal jurisdiction.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
You're in charge. Okay. 4 months ago, the United States Senate, on a bipartisan basis, on a voice vote, took action and said, you know what? No senator in this body is allowed to make bets on prediction markets. Every Republican, every Democrat agreed to it. Why can't we?
We have moved forward legislation in the committee and House administration on this topic.
Let's
I look
do it
forward
today.
To I'd be.
Why can't we? I'm saying this happened in April. We could do a one-page resolution. We could just literally cut and paste the Senate resolution, and we could pass it tomorrow. Will you help us with that?
Yeah, so I've been supportive of making restrictions in the prediction market space.
Why isn't it in this bill?
We have two different pieces of legislation. We moved through. Obviously, prediction markets are a reasonably new and novel technology bill.
It took the Senate day. It's a one-page resolution. It literally is a paragraph. It just says members of the Senate are banned from participating in prediction markets.
I'm fully supportive of my legislation moving forward, if that's the question.
No, the question is, I guess I'll follow with Mr. Morelli, and maybe, Mr. Morelli, I would...
Will you be shocked to learn that this Republican, Wisconsin Congressman Brian Steele, has received a ton of contributions from the crypto and blockchain industries? He's
They're
the chair
industries.
Of the House Subcommittee on Digital Assets, which would be, relevant for the crypto industry. Coinbase, Gemini, Solana, backed his campaign, the crypto pack, I should say. Independent Expenditures by Fairshake, their pack.
Maybe
you
they
know.
All just thought he'd be the best candidate for the country.
Right, exactly. They were just being patriotic.
Or he's a big fat crook.
Could be that. Could be that. He is a Republican that has benefited quite a bit from cryptocurrency donations. And, the prediction markets, they're a relatively new technology.
Like,
they're worried
gambling's
about,
a new idea.
Yeah, and that's why we have to just really ruminate on the concept of gambling on, say, like the length of the Iran war.
It just missed the deadline.
Information that only members of Congress can have, just directly betting on information that they can get, as opposed to even the less direct stock trading piece, which still relies on the market. You're literally placing a bet when you know it's like you're the Gatorade guy at the Super Bowl and you know that it's going to be blue Gatorade that's poured on the coach and you're making a bet on it being blue Gatorade. And that's what this bill allows for every single member of Congress.
Yeah, no, it's an industry that's so new that we can't regulate it, but it's not so new that I can't take thousands of dollars from it.
Yeah, right. Right.
See what it turns into.
Yeah, it's for research.
Look, we're under deadlines, guys.
I'm trying to understand
trying to
them
everything
more.
You need me to talk. You need me to look into everything I'm getting money from?
Yeah. You enjoy my socialism. My husband calls Landers Cadence Jew Jazz. Okay, well, I did not say that, so.
I think Jewish people participated in jazz. Quite notably.
Yeah, right, right.
Just called jazz.
Jazz, yeah. Ryan from Santa Monica. My great-grandfather was one of the original California investors in the Transcontinental Railroad. When he was elected to Congress in 1862, he sold all of his stocks because if he voted to support the railroad, it would be for the good of his constituent state and country, not for his own personal gain. This seemed obvious to him in 1862. Why is it so difficult for legislators
now? He
sounds
woke.
Well, because they're getting rich, buddy. They're getting rich.
You would have been so rich if he didn't make that dumb decision.
I know. Sorry. You would have had generational wealth.
Yeah, you would have had, like, neighborhood in Manhattan named after you.
Exactly.
It is funny, like, we learned about, like, the Teapot Dome scandal. And, like, you look into it now after just two Trump terms. You're like,
I know.
They get this? Like, right. I mean, this happens every... This is, like, what... This is like the main business of Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Let's quickly... Okay, what did we want to get to here? Oh, just quickly, this ICE thing. So Republicans continue to blame the government shutdown for the reason that these ICE officers who killed people all across the country in recent weeks weren't wearing body cameras. We've gone into this before. They're making it up. ICE and DHS was fully funded during the government shutdown. Additionally, they had $20 million that was allocated to them specifically for body cameras in the appropriations bill. And they're just not using it. They also are so funded. I mean, they are now more funded than the FBI. They had nearly $30 billion that came in as another massive funding package that they could be looking into in terms of purchasing this technology in 2025, on top of just the money that keeps pouring into them. So the idea that they just couldn't have invested in body cameras is a little rich and ridiculous. And they're lying about their operations during the government shutdown, which were unabated. So here's Tom Homan now whining about how and honestly cracking under pressure as he's getting questioned about the ICE's abuses over the past few weeks. He storms out of this press conference in front of the White House yesterday and is typically very difficult to understand in this clip. Here he is whining, moaning, throwing a tantrum. Because he does look like the ugliest baby I've ever seen, to be honest with you. Baby needs a diaper change.
Get some peptides to Tom.
I'm not making this up. We're enforcing laws they wrote, and that they appropriate us money to enforce. Now, I'll say it once again. If ICE agents act inappropriately or illegal...
Sorry, can you say it one more time?
Yeah. I'll say it again.
Sounds like a Novocaine addict.
Yeah, I mean, has anyone ever seen his tongue, and does he have one, or is it just comically
it's all
large?
Tongue.
Or it's all tongue, right? All tongue.
I'm usually not supportive of federal drug testing policy, but like, what the?
I mean, we've got to know. For some of these guys, we've got to know.
Once again, if ICE agents act inappropriately or illegal, they'll be held accountable, just like they were held accountable in Minnesota. Everybody, you know, guys, ICE agents are mom and dads too. They don't hang their heart on a hook every day to do this job. And it's just not attacking the ICE agents, it's attacking their spouses and children, and no one knows that better than me. I can't even go get a quart of milk at a grocery store without a security detail. Why? Because I'm enforcing laws in this country. It's pathetic and it's disgusting.
I'm the victim here.
That's interesting. I mean, this seems to me like this is there's a huge morale problem with ICE. When he starts talking like this, like they have hearts, which, you know, I mean, the guy who shot the fellow in Maine killed him and then called his ex-wife up to say, please lie about my character.
And she was like, no, you were really abusive. And then a second ex-wife came out and said the same thing.
Yeah
maybe he shouldn't have gotten a gun because they're literally letting any Tom, Dick, and Harry come in and just be, you know, some brutal Gestapo agent.
The type of people that are signing up to be ICE are not the best of our best. They're, in fact, often
the worst
dangerous
of the worst.
type of folks who should be kept an eye on instead of deputized by the state with a fucking firearm.
You know who else are human beings with hearts? the families that you're breaking up, the people that you're killing in the streets,
the people in the detention centers that you're making money off of.
Yeah, languishing. Over 50 people have died in ICE custody in these camps since Trump came back into office, and that's who we know about. And like
the Gestapo agents, their moms and dads too.
Exactly. The New York Times, just to just pull up this link, we can just read the headline, had an article yesterday saying that, like, they're going to be held. He says they're going to be held accountable. This is the administration. Just, you could just put the headline up. Federal agents were told FBI will no longer investigate ICE confrontations.
And that's because, so like there was this idea like, oh, we can investigate with the FBI the people who are having confrontations with ICE and get them in trouble. But what they found out was, in the course of doing an investigation, the FBI might find out that actually ICE provoked this or is lying, in fact, about what they said is happening. And they didn't want to deal with that anymore. So the FBI is just like, you guys investigate yourselves.
Yeah. And also, I should say, Popular Info, which is a really good outfit that you can, I think, support on Substack, they looked into this, and they found, about the body cameras at the very least, that ICE had not purchased body cams, even though Tom Holman was claiming that they had, and they had the funds available to them. So Popular Info was able to get information confirming that they hadn't made this purchase that they're saying that they made. And again, though, we are not a show that is in favor, really, I think, of like body cameras as the
complete distraction,
as the way to really curb ICE's abuses, because there's a reason that like Cory Booker loves the body camera stuff. And it's because surveillance technology benefits much more from body cameras than they would without. And while narrowly, in some instances, it might help provide more evidence for these killings, we already have endless camera angles of the killings of Alex Preddy and Renee Good. And I mean, some of the footage also that came out of Houston, some of the footage that came out of Maine, where you show them handcuffing his lifeless body, his head bangs off the ground as they drag him out from the car. Like, we have this footage. And justice still isn't happening. It's because of the nature of the agency, not because of some sort of technology that's going to be a panacea.
Talking about body cams naturalizes the idea that I should be doing any of this shit at all. It's like, I mean, should the Gestapo have body cameras?
Right.
Like, it's a ludicrous question.
And do I think that ICE should have a mass trove of facial recognition data accessible to them that's going to only be made more, you know, frequent and have a larger database with these body cameras?
Yeah, fed into AI and used for surveillance. Exactly.
No, none of this should happen. This is not what, like, this is a violation of so many different people's civil liberties, in addition to just being cruel and sadistic and an ethnic cleansing campaign that should not be legitimized, as you say, Matt, by these kinds of conversation. And it's where liberals just have no ability to actually meet the moment.
Well, it's a triangulation Bill Clinton shit where we got to take this somewhat seriously. No, the entire reason that these ICE agents are in the field is because of a hysterical white nationalist, again, white panic about demographics. It's not even about really like, I mean, it benefits business owners because they can, like Trump did with the Trump Tower, employ undocumented people. And if they get too uppity, then call the deportation services on them. But this is really about like Stephen Miller type Nazi demographic control. And there's no rationalization for it. There's none at all.
Science is political. Geez, Emma, it's because Booker is trying to end all human suffering, and a body camera not abolishing ICE is the only way to do it. Not Sam Cedar says Renee Good's killer filmed the killing himself. Right.
I mean, it is. It should be taken as insulting when people, especially liberals, bring up body cameras. I mean, particularly like about ICE.
Yes.
Like it's frankly ludicrous about police too, but ICE is even more absurd.
Okay, what should we get to here? Should we open up the phone lines? I'll read some IMs. I'm distracted by my camera today. I got to be honest with you guys. I'm trying to. Should I try to re-enter or something like that? It's just driving me nuts.
I mean, we could try. Yeah, we could take a quick break here.
Maybe. Yeah. All right, we are back. Let's hope things have improved on the camera front, folks. Gage from Utah, do you all worry about your support for DSA making you a target for this administration, like how Hassan's being targeted? I just joined DSA, lol. Yeah, we're going to have Ken Klippenstein on tomorrow to talk about some of those developments, I think.
I was saying before the show, if my passport wasn't still good for like a half decade plus, I would think about either redoing it now, and actually, if a Democrat wins the White House next time, I'll probably do it a little
renew
bit early.
It. Yeah.
But it doesn't surprise. I'll say like where we're headed here. I remember, frankly, talking to Michael about like when TMBS started taking off and we started doing illicit histories. It's like this sort of openness in media has never really been tolerated in America, in American history. Like previously it had been like pamphlets and stuff like that. This sort of wide audience. And so, yeah, it's not a surprise that you see the State Department saying, hey, McCarthyism did a pretty good job of completely undermining the left, because it did. Yeah. We pat ourselves on the back, with like, oh, we stood up to that. Well, it completely, purged the left out of particularly like Hollywood at the time. And so I think they probably shouldn't, congratulate ourselves so much unless we're like anti-communists.
Yeah.
Which I'm not.
What should we do here? Yeah, sure. Let's have fun with it. We're fans of the Koch children, in this studio.
We support them.
We support them and their artistic endeavors and their ability to use their generational wealth for comedic, I mean, artistic purposes in terms of self-expression, Wyatt Koch and all of his fancy, shirts, you know, those are very, we have a prop here actually to that effect. Matt Cam is going to be extra fashionable today. You see? Mr. Moneybags over there. Gosh, and the lining on one side. Right, so if you button it up, then it means that the green part stands out. Oh, my. I mean, wow, how fashionable. there you go. Look at that. Pop the collar, yes. Mr. Moneybags. That's gorgeous.
More on Wyatt in a second, but his cousin has hit the ground running.
Okay.
She recently graduated from college, and Wall Street Journal's like, hey, we've got an offer for you. Now, I'll say this.
She must have had a really good GPA.
I had a pretty good GPA when I went to intern in London and through an internship program. And I remember requesting, hey, I'd like to work for like the New Statesman or the Guardian or something like that. And they basically laughed at me and said, you need to know somebody or go to like Oxford or something like that. So it's a little bit interesting to see who gets to go right into the Wall Street Journal after straight out of college. And it turns out having your mom be one of the richest women in the world, worth about $75 billion.
Yeah.
Because it's from the Koch brothers, the David Koch, who died in 2019. Rest in power, David. it's a nice chunk of change, but, you know, you got to fill your day somehow.
Yes.
You can't just, like, live off of inherited money, so you need to find something that you believe in. And wouldn't you know that, what's her name, Julie Marie Koch or Mary something Koch?
Mary Julia Koch.
Mary Julia Koch. One of her passions is...
Koch?
Is supporting capitalism.
So this is part of the new kind of vertical video pro-billionaire explainer model.
Yeah, you know, Vox has their own thing too.
Well, we've also played and made fun of the Washington Post's efforts to talk about how the billionaire tax wouldn't actually do anything.
Yep, that's Make It Make Sense.
Oh, gotcha.
You're against like you think free diapers? Who's going to pay for the free diapers?
Right. Okay.
This propaganda needs to be accessible to the illiterate.
Yes. Yes. And the Journal, I guess, is getting in on the fun here with a literal Koch descendant to tell us about how democratic socialism isn't exactly like the Nordic model, and we shouldn't like it that much.
America's democratic socialists are obsessed with the Nordic model. Universal healthcare, big welfare states, all sold with Instagram-worthy aesthetics. The only problem? These countries aren't socialist. Their economies are highly competitive free markets, built on private ownership and global trade. Finland, Denmark, Iceland, and Sweden consistently rank among the top 15 countries with the most economic and personal freedom. Scandinavian countries do offer more public services than the U.S., but they're paid for by broad and steep taxation.
Okay.
And it's not like the citizens are just sitting around collecting benefits. In Norway, labor force participation is higher than it is in the U.S. Yes, these countries have lower levels of crime and economic...
Now, that was where, I mean, Matt Brunig made this point here, but that is where you know that, like, this young lady doesn't know what the fuck she's talking about. Here is a Matt Brunig making the point. Wall Street Journal really going downhill. One of the points here is that Norway has high labor force participation. Like, that's a standalone point for how they are capitalists. That people work. First time I've ever seen that. It is bizarre to say, like...
High labor participation?
Yeah.
Like, here in the United States, the Fed for many years has attempted to create, like, some level of artificial unemployment to make sure that workers are a little bit more desperate. I mean, that's been a part of what is unsaid about that. That's Greenspan, too. Are we less capitalist than Norway?
And despite the steeper taxation, as she puts it, to pay for all these social services and goods provided to people by the state, they still go to work.
That's
because
so
I
weird.
Would have thought that you would have just stayed home and taken all the government benefits like they say they would do.
No. I'm reminded of that Matt Damon clip that's been going around where he says to the cameraman, do you think that, like, you know, essentially scarcity or incentives make you are why I go to work every day? That's a pro-capitalist myth, the idea that people would just be like lazing around if and that would be this mass problem if there wasn't this sort of, you know, axe hanging over their neck.
Yep.
Yes, these countries have lower levels of crime and economic inequality and higher levels of public trust, but they're ethnically and culturally homogenous.
There you go. It's always that.
So this is a big tell, and this is why there's so much invested by rich people like this girl's dead dad toward racism,
mm-hmm.
because they need this to be true. And one thing it's never really explained by this is why is it that socialism becomes more and less popular over time, that seemingly associated with when capitalism is failing, like it did in the 20s and 30s. A lot more pro, frankly, like there's a lot of like communist fellow travelers even in the U.S. government at the time, very popular because capitalism was failing in the same way it is now, which is why it's getting popular now. We're not getting more homogenous.
No, I mean, it's also interesting to me how, like, she basically says that Norway and these other Nordic policies are actually capitalists and, you know, that we shouldn't use them as a model for socialism because they're not really socialists, but also don't look further into it because whatever policies they even try as capitalist countries can't be replicated here because we have too many black and brown people in this country.
Yeah, they can only do it because they're white. Never mind, like, the polling on these
right.
things.
They can only do what I'm calling capitalism erroneous or capital. I guess they are mixed economies. That's the reality, but not what she's talking about in terms of the, you know, healthcare and public college.
Look,
stuff.
If they're so capitalist, let's see what they're doing right.
Exactly.
Particularly in terms of, they got higher labor force participation. Maybe we should do universal healthcare.
Maybe.
And so much smaller than America. The population of the New York City metro area is 4 times the size of the entire country of Norway. We're comparing apples to oranges.
That's an advantage.
Right.
The larger your risk pool is for something like insurance, the more you can spread it around.
That's why we support a single payer system.
We actually have a bigger pie to spread around.
Right. That gives the government the most amount of leverage in negotiating prices down. If it's just a public option,
so yeah,
then you still have to compete with the private marketplace that can artificially keep their prices high and also only take on the healthier patients may stay on with private insurance, and patients that have more that struggle more or don't have the economic resources to be able to pay for higher prices, they'll go with the public option, but that makes it so the risk pool isn't advantageous in negotiations.
And I'll just say, like, we are comparing apple and oranges is, you know, sounds smart if you're an idiot, but we're actually comparing nations.
Yes. Yes.
And right. Policy.
And a proud white nation versus this cesspool here in the United States.
That could never do something like universal healthcare.
Yeah.
Country of Norway. We're comparing apples to oranges. By the way, Norway is Western Europe's largest oil and natural gas producer. That's the reason for their economic success, not the welfare state. If today's socialist sympathizers really want inspiration...
We also produce a lot of oil.
Yes. I also, don't they... didn't we just kind of kidnap the leader of Venezuela in order to take over their oil reserves? So are they not a socialist communist country by her metric, which is, you know, how they like to talk about Venezuela because they produce oil and gas?
Yeah.
If today's socialist sympathizers really want inspiration, they should look to Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea.
There we go.
Russia. I wonder why they never mention those countries.
It's funny, like Soviet Russia, they're no longer Soviet.
No.
And guess what? It's more capitalist now. And I don't think you could say it's improved.
In fact, like in terms of models of where the United States is going, Russia's probably the closest one, given the level of cronyism and state, you know, corruption that is in Russia. Trump is much closer to Putin in that way.
And I'll just say there's an oversight here. Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, Soviet Russia. There is one country that calls itself communist,
mm-hmm.
and it is outproducing us like fucking crazy. China, for folks following at home, makes better cars than we do now. We have to protect ourselves from BYD. They signed Steph Curry. Their shoes are catching up on all these other countries that export it. China is outproducing us. China is not a capitalist country.
Right.
They have markets. They're not capitalist.
Empathizers really want inspiration. They should look to Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, Soviet Russia. I wonder why they never mention those countries.
Probably because Soviet Russia hasn't existed since I've been alive and hasn't existed for like a decade since you were born. But again, what's shocking to me about this is we like cannot confront the fact that America isn't the dominant producer as it had been.
Right.
There's like a huge blind spot that we can't even, we're afraid to look at it.
I mean, Cuba even as well, in terms of like their outcomes, given what the United States has imposed
the boot
on
its
it
neck, yeah.
Right off of our shores. It's a remarkable success story.
But so that was one of the Coke kids, and that gives us a reason to go back to a classic clip here.
Yes.
Our boy Wyatt Coke, here he is. This is from, I believe, 2017.
I remember this, honestly, like it was yesterday, this video. It was before I even joined here, and it's just so memorable. This is his promo ad for the aforementioned fashion line.
Almost a decade since this came
out. Unreal.
My father said to me, Wyatt, you can do whatever you want to in life, but just make sure you do it well and you do it with passion. Every day I go to the office, I enjoy creating the clothes.
This is like a magician's.
I'm not. I mean,
the ugliest shirt.
The ugliest shirt. This literally looks like a paintball. I don't know, arena, basically, right?
Right.
When you turn off all of the lights, those are going to glow in the dark or something.
They're just warning flags for women.
Yeah, exactly. Right, right.
This looks like the collection that you could find in, like, the bazaar in Aladdin.
Yeah. You can see him coming because the palm trees glow in the dark, so be prepared.
Be bold means to me, be authentic, be real, be yourself,
be
confident.
Be gaudy.
That is the worst drawing I've ever seen in my life.
I know.
Wait, can you go back to that drawing?
Yeah.
What?
First of all, he didn't even do it. Secondly, it's awful. And he's pretending like he's in the lab designing these patterns.
You don't think he did that? Who, they got somebody else to do that?
I think that
might be him.
That maybe that is him. Maybe that was his artistic contribution to the ad.
I would say, like, probably leave that out of the edit.
Well,
that is so real.
He's hands on, Matt. He's hands on.
He's probably like the one who put this video together. Too,
yeah, right? Duh.
Be confident and always be a gentleman, but still have that tenacity that no one can take away from you.
That's what I see when I look at you, buddy. Tenacity.
I want my shirts to be able to be worn in the boardroom or in a discotheque or a nightclub.
Oh, man.
I think he might have been telling them, yeah, I had to sue my ex-fiance for the $250,000 ring that I gave her, which is a true story that was happening at the exact same time. There's not a lot of news that's come out about Wyatt Cook, but...
No, but why not? You have more money than God. You're not going to let the woman keep the ring. I mean, this is what rich people are like.
Look
I guess
at the, I forgot this is pink handcuffs
because he's a sexual matador. Matt, what are you missing?
I mean, this is what young men
this
we needed a role model
men.
And it was in our face all the time wearing an insane polo.
Be worn in the boardroom or in a discotheca or a nightclub or on a yacht.
Yeah, discotheca.
I really
I'm
wanted to create
party.
Something that's fun, outside the box, cool, trendy, yet really bold and interesting.
Did he say bold like 3 or 4 times?
Yes. I mean, it is probably the main thing you could say about his shirts.
It's the nicest way you could say garish, gaudy.
So who wins between the cousins?
Wyatt's always
exactly
win
Wyatt.
Over.
I mean, I'm sorry, Mary Julia, whatever your name
Maybe
is.
Maybe she goes by MJ. That would be cool.
I'd like to see her fashion line more than I'd like to see any more of her talking about
political talk.
Aside
hey.
From the sweatshop employees who made it and the women who were forced to talk to him in the filming of that video,
right.
It's harmless.
It's a little bit harmless.
Where
exactly.
She's actively trying to
be a propaganda object for like the worst parts of society right now.
Where was it made?
Made in USA of imported fabric, though.
Oh, well, that's not shocking. I mean, it must have been the finest silk.
It doesn't quite feel like
it's
that.
It's a cotton polyester blend? Gotta be, right?
Yeah, 100% cotton.
Okay.
All right, made in the USA, 100%
All right,
cotton.
Wyatt.
Yeah, he destroys her. It's not even close.
That's our
like,
president.
I think Ronald Reagan can get in touch with how much this costs, because I think he's the one who bought it. But I think it.
I do want to know now. Maybe Reagan can shine a light on this. Sam's slutty little glasses says, no way that EDM isn't Israeli EDM in the back of it. Yeah. I mean, it's a good chance. Chris Burdick, this woman makes me wonder if they're breeding Olivia Rheingold in a clone lab that has isolated the smugness gene.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad.
D Hall 30, Scandinavia isn't socialist. They just do high taxes and have good opportunities and social supports for their citizens. Why don't we have that?
One of those countries publicly, like, your tax information is public.
Right.
Like, you're
right.
You can look it up online.
Ronald Vegan says, has anyone told the Koch children that the drum and bass style hasn't been in since 2010?
Well, first of all, that was 2017. So.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, he's bringing it back. Fratter 12, imagine thinking communists never bring up Cuba or the Soviet Union. Also, I can't
That's
be the only
true, yeah.
one who's calling them the Cox for years. No, it's Cokes. It's Cokes. But, I mean, more power to you.
It was hard for me because there's a...
Ed Koch is
yeah.
same spelling.
In the Dakotas, it's spelled cock. Yeah. I'm just cock.
E. Debs says, the discussion about capitalism and socialism is childish. Every society on the planet has elements of both. Clearly, we have determined that the market is best for allocating some things while others should be allocated to the state democratically.
I don't even know if that's not really the thing. Like, markets have existed long before. Bhaskar made this point with Ross Douthat, but... I mean, markets predated capitalism by centuries.
Yeah.
And are a way, like, trade is just, like, part of the human condition. Whether you have a system set up where one individual controls all these firms for profit and gets to decide, like, how much of the revenue I get to decide is mine at the end of the day, that's the system that That's capitalism.
Yeah.
It's surplus value creation and expropriation from laborers.
Let's do, which Mamdani clip do you think is best?
Oh, that can actually bring us to the, do we have the small business one?
Yeah, I think we do. Let's do that then.
That's actually exactly what we're talking about.
We could do a whole segment on these Netanyahu things tomorrow.
Yes.
The blowback is, or whatever.
So. Yeah, I think we could talk about it then. Let's we'll do 11 here. So there's, you know, all this talk from capitalist billionaires that Mamdani is horrible for innovation, for small business and socialism, and this kind of, you know, more aggressive posture towards corporate greed is just going to hurt innovation. The reality is that Zoran Mamdani was really smart in his campaign about gearing it towards the needs of small businesses and appealing to small business owners on that level, because there are a lot of onerous things that small business owners have to deal with here in the city. And cracking down on major corporations is very different than, say, the bodega that has to deal with the city very directly and oftentimes with really small margins. So here's Zoran Mamdani talking about the removal of unnecessary permits and licenses for small businesses, and he explains why this is important.
Now, there are few pleasures quite as simple or satisfying as a chocolate milkshake on a hot day. Yet for thousands of small businesses...
Okay, capitalist.
Okay, yeah. Do you use money to buy that?
Yeah, it sounds like, okay, Jeff Bezos over here.
Using all that filmmaker money.
Yeah,
he gets Neapolitan because it's a Nepo baby.
Nepo baby.
Pleasures quite as simple or satisfying as a chocolate milkshake on a hot day. Yet for thousands of small business owners, behind the simplicity of a sweet treat, complexity often lurks. For too long, restaurant owners and street vendors have been forced to apply for not...
We should do a for too long counter.
I mean, he didn't even do the four in there. So he just said for too long. Oh, wait, he did.
I mean, all the DSA candidates who won their primaries have inherited that
Daria
as well.
Yes. So he'll say for far too long and sometimes for too long. That's a tick of his.
And for so many New Yorkers.
Oh, yeah, right. In this city. That's the other thing.
For so many. For far too long.
We're sorry, Zoran.
Anyway, we're supporting Zoran.
We love you.
We love Zoran, but I'll never drink a milkshake on a hot day.
chocolate milkshake on a hot day is not what I would have gone with. But
I mean, I like milkshakes, but I don't particularly think, like, oh, a hot day, I need to go get a
dairy bomb for your belly.
Lurks. For too long, restaurant owners and street vendors have been forced to apply for not one, but two permits if they want to serve warm food and cold dairy desserts at the same location. Mm. Today, my friends, we are lifting the freeze that too many New Yorkers must contend with as we launch Open for Small Businesses. Open, which stands for Overhauling Procedures and Expanding Navigation, is a package of more than 50 reforms that cut red tape, eliminate redundant fees, and streamline the permitting process. In a win for every ice cream lover across New York City, we will work with the state to do away with the frozen dessert permit that requires restaurants to seek out a superfluous second permit for what they're already doing, serving food. No more treatsploitation, as we say. Right now, barbershops need three licenses to cut hair. One to be a barber, one to own the shop, and one from the city on top of both. The state of affairs is frankly anti-fade, and we will not stand for it, which is why we will work with the state to streamline these licenses as well. And to the bingo enthusiasts out there, for too long, the potential earnings of a hot street at bingo
drink your milkshake
have been capped by arcane rules that no longer reflect how the game is actually being played. With Open, DCWP will remove unnecessary regulations, including prize limits. These are just a few of the improvements we are proud to announce today as we make it clear we are in the pocket of Big Abuela. Our reforms touch virtually every sector, from bodegas that have to apply for a license to sell identical goods outside versus inside their shop, to the childcare providers who have to navigate three different agencies, overlapping processes before they can actually get up and running. Most of all, we could clap for the childcare providers. You know, in this city, when there is something that we see that we want to celebrate, we say that it's a miracle, that these are miracle workers. We don't want to have to ask people to be miracle workers. Mm-hmm. We want them to just be able to do what they should have always been able to do, which is work with a city government that's responsive. Because most of all, open will not only make it easier to run a small business, but to open that small business, to reach for that most American of dreams here in New York City, to understand how these...
I love this shit so much.
It's just such good politics. And also, I mean, you have these like centrist types that are praising him, like, okay, like reform of rules. I'm okay. I'm listening. I saw Sarah Longwell was like, oh, you know, the abundance crowd loves this, but they pretend like these are false or these are distinct visions that the socialist left or the DSA left doesn't want to get rid of red tape like this. Mamdani is proving in real time how that has always been a false choice that is presented. And that actually, in fact, an economy that's more geared towards working people and including like small business owners in the context of New York City, which is, you know, that's not working people, right? I mean, they own their own business technically, but they're
petty bourgeois.
But petty bourgeois in Marxist terms. But that would Mamdani also has this understanding that these small businesses, as I mentioned earlier, are operating on such small margins, and they're still working incredibly hard and not necessarily taking home these great returns and aren't rich themselves because they are also subject to these large, like, market consolidating forces that are keeping our wages down as well. So he's bringing those New Yorkers into the fold, and that's where his, you know, more expansive definition of working people is just really good politics.
He's eating this sort of centrist lunch because they can't actually deliver on this stuff because they're too beholden to the big corporations that benefit from the massive bureaucracy, frankly.
Right.
Yeah, it would be nice if the Sarah Longwell types ever got around to doing this stuff as actively as Zoran is. But Zoran isn't pulled in multiple directions by it. He just supports small businesses. And the small businesses... I remember in the campaign started seeing Zoran flyers up. This is a guy, like, conservatives don't understand. Like, how does the guy who's talking about a public grocery store have all the support of the bodega owners and stuff like that? It's because of stuff like this. And because they're not actually providing the, like, groceries without, like, government support themselves.
Yes.
Like, this is policy.
Right.
And we just have a massively wasteful one because we... like previously have been corrupted by bigger business, but you can just do these sorts of things.
And it's why, you know, he's really a social democrat. Like, he's a member of or governing as a social democrat and he's a socialist, yes, in his ideology, but there's an understanding and a practicality right now with democratic socialists that in the near term, this is the kind of, like, you know, good governance that is beneficial for more socializing policies as opposed to, you know, the more long-term goals of a socialized economy. This is just good politics, beneficial for his agenda as well, and great messaging.
Yeah, by the metrics of a typical politician, he's winning. By the metrics of, like, a socialist revolutionary, it's, you know, how does this translate into ultimately overthrowing capitalism and having a socialist economy? That is an open question that will have to take a lot of, like, work by people who, like, join DSA and that sort of thing. But in terms of, like, being a politician in the current state of affairs, like, Zoran is better than... There's a reason his popularity is up and Spamburgers isn't down. And Nir Tanden can cry about it as much as he wants.
And he understands that delivering on his agenda here is the most important thing that he could do for the socialist movement as a leader in this country right now, governing in a way where you see... Like, I saw local reporters in Detroit... took a photo of Zoran merch being sold at the AOC Bernie Abdullah Sayed rally. Like, he is a national figure for this reason. I was actually talking to this guy who works at a place near my apartment, and he was saying that he was just in Ireland for a wedding and that everyone was talking about Zoran. Oh, you're from New York? You're from New York? God, we love him. I mean, he and AOC are really international figures right now. And I think, you know, that's what gives me optimism in these dark days. I also did want to mention, I totally messed up earlier. I'm so sorry, guys. Arizona is primaries are today. I should have headlined this. It's my bad. Arizona primaries are today. Kai Newkirk, Sam interviewed him on the show, running in Arizona's fourth. That's the candidate you should support, I'm sure. If you are tuning into the show, you've already heard that. But if you're in Arizona, go out and vote today. And if you haven't already. Ad hominem says, it only took 7 months for MR to turn on Mamdani.
We turn on politicians for things they do, how they deliver speeches.
Yes, exactly.
It happened with another politician, but we're not going to talk about that.
It does bother me.
Brian just...
The one Matt's referencing, Mamdani didn't bother me.
Brian just jumped out the window.
Okay. Yeah, we're not going to talk about that.
I changed my affiliation. Yeah.
To be my mayor.
Yeah, we
missed. You're not a New Yorker. You have no clue.
We missed the opportunity for that. With Abuela, we missed that as grandma. We missed it. He is really. He's in the pocket of Big Grandma, Big Grandma / Abuela.
That is grandma.
California Resistance, Emma, quality of life issues, winners every time in everyday lives. Went through this with flight paths and noise redirected to southern Bergen County where I live. From rich big bucks, northern Bergen County for Newark Airport. Otter, can we get a Mamdani counter for the things he's gotten done? I want to see how much he's gotten done compared. And I think you got cut off there. Scrounger, anybody who will do what they say they will do and deliver in a positive way will win and keep winning. Leftist Big Pharma plug. That is Abuela. Yes. Vox Populi. Oh my God, I love this Zoran clip so much. For all the national attention he gets, he's still a mayor, and I love that he cares about these small scale things that contribute to the experience and quality of everyday life.
I mean, I, for one, like that I don't have to deal with chain restaurants. Thing, like moving from like North Dakota to here, and you have options of like smaller restaurants and stuff like that. Like theoretically, like yes, those workers are often very regularly exploited too, and they should have more protections for it. But I think it's good to have smaller business as opposed to big. And I think that only the capitalism will tend toward monopolization unless the government steps in.
Yep, that's it. Supporting small business. I should have made this point in the segment, I guess. But, you know, like when the economy is poor, consolidation is the natural and expansion for the companies that have the capital to do so is like the way the economy is naturally going to go unless the state intervenes to support small businesses. So when you hear Republicans talk about small businesses, they're lying. They just care about big business.
Anything that isn't a small business should have even more onerous state control and regulation over it.
They only care about a business that is either trading on the S&P 500 or will eventually trade on the S&P 500 or bought by a company that's trading on the S&P 500. Dan from Columbus. Soviet Russia was such a failure that we had to fake the moon landing just to win the space race. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, to go from feudalism to kicking America's ass into gear over the space race is an accomplishment, which is not to defend like the brutality of the failed like farm collectivization under Stalin and the purge trials and stuff like that.
Three more. Randy Marsh of South Park, Colorado says more like Diet Coke. Okay, I don't get it.
I think maybe he's calling Wyatt Coke a little heavy set.
How dare you?
Wyatt as passion.
He's bold.
You can see him down the discoteca.
Mass teacher, when will that is grandma be added to the MR Discord soundboard? That's a question.
I didn't know
Discord.
The MR Discord did have a soundboard, but if you need it clean.
That is grandma.
There you go.
That is grandma.
That is grandma. And the final I am of the day. Cheese says, I can confirm that Zoran's appeal has international reach. I talk to people in Sweden about him quite frequently. Well, he could never be mayor there because they would reject him for being Muslim.
Yeah,
because yep. that's all that homogenous. Matters. Too homogenous to endure to
and
be.
Like our very yeah
yeah. What is Sweden's population size? It's actually probably the same as I would guess as New York. Okay, 10 million, so a little bit larger. But
it's a shithole country that couldn't even afford to lose a war for 20 years in Afghanistan. So
comparable. All right, guys, thank you so much. Appreciate you all. We will see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking. Meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somebody